It's hard to believe that this day, September 18th, marks the 50th anniversary of CBS Radio. For most of us, CBS is an institution that seems always to have been here. But 50 years ago today, it all began. For the next 3 hours, we're going to take a look back at that beginning and at the days and years between to recall some of the highlights of CBS Radio's first 50 years. And we'll begin in a moment.
And now, Bill Schallert with an opening word from General Electric.
Tonight's messages from General Electric will take you on a tour of some interesting places in our country and try to tell you something. Something of the progress GE has made in fields like medicine, communications, aviation, power generation, and home appliances. And you might keep this in mind as you listen. Where progress has been made in the past, it's likely to be made in the future. So GE expects to keep right on making progress. Progress for people from General Electric.
Now, CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound. Here is CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite.
The first sound on the CBS Radio network was music. And it was music that dominated CBS programming for the next three decades. The year 1927 was the beginning of it all. A new network called the Columbia Phonograph Broadcasting System, later shortened to the Columbia Broadcasting System, made its debut on the air. Life in America appeared carefree, even madcap then. It was the era of the flapper, the speakeasy, jazz. New York was the entertainment capital of the nation and the center of a new industry called broadcasting. And here is one of the hit tunes CBS Radio was playing that year. Radio's musical repertoire also included classical music. CBS Radio had its own symphony orchestra from the beginning. In 1927, it was under the direction of Howard Barlow. Later, it was led by such distinguished guest conductors as Alfredo Antonini and Bernard Herrmann. On this day, exactly 50 years ago, the CBS Radio Network debuted with a six-hour program of musical variety. The highlight was an American opera by Deems Taylor called The King's Henchman, featuring cast members from the Metropolitan Opera. Unfortunately, the original air production was not recorded. Taping was a thing of the future. But here is a 1942 recording of that opera with Deems Taylor narrating, just as he had done on that first CBS day. Lawrence Tibbett is heard singing the lead.
It is nearly time for Athelwold to start on his journey. He and the king exchange pledges of eternal brotherhood. His horse is led to the door. And now Macus, Athelwold's man-at-arms, who is to accompany him on his mission, springs to his feet and leads the crowd in an old Saxon drinking song, in which he is joined by Edgar and Athelwold.
See the great was Bob, and Julius was thy name.
How we can ring the bell, and Julius was thy name.
Then put thy way through fellow's grim, saw me print and came.
Bob,
I would not stand a care for anybody quicksander.
The next year, 1928, a young man named William S. Paley of Philadelphia bought controlling interest in the Columbia Network. Hardly a network at all by today's standards, only 16 stations. As he told a CBS News producer in an interview for this broadcast, Paley came to New York with something specific in mind for the new network.
The first thing I had to do when I got over here was to organize the company and to change the program schedule altogether. We were getting no place with what we had, and start to build an organization, which, funnily enough, was not very easy to do. My friends, for instance, in Philadelphia, thought I was crazy. They thought this radio was a sort of a passing fancy. And when I got to New York, I had difficulty hiring people. I didn't sit down and say, this isn't my program for radio as to what I think it ought to become. But I got educated to its potentials and little by little started to evolve a philosophy and a plan. In those days, nobody was making radio sets. There were no brand names. If you wanted one, you had to get a hold of a technician who knew how to put one together. And that's what I did, and I bought my first crystal set. And then would sit around until 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning trying to get KDKA in Pittsburgh. And there was a station in Kansas City. I think I got once or twice, which is very exciting. But even before I got into it as a business, I saw it as a bit of magic, as a medium that was able, I thought, at some future time to communicate with all the people in the country and all the people in the world. And what a fantastic thing this was.
Under William Paley's hand in the next decade, the 1930s, CBS programming came into its own. Through the 1930s, dance bands were an important feature of evening and weekend radio listening. One of the biggest and most famous bands of the era was Paul Whiteman's orchestra. And among Whiteman's early vocalists was a young man named Bing Crosby, who had first been featured as one of a trio calling itself the Rhythm Boys. Paley heard Crosby on a recording one day and offered him a show of his own on the network in 1931.
Ain't so, honey, ain't so. Spoke to the Lord said no, ain't so. Honey, ain't so. Ain't so, honey, ain't so. The devil said yes, but the Lord said no, ain't so. Honey, ain't so.
Dance music was a boon for those with no money to spend on entertainment during the Depression. Going to nightclubs and buying records were for the rich. John Hammond, an executive with Columbia Records then and long associated with CBS, recalls how much dance band music was heard on the radio then and on into the 1940s.
All radio stations in those days had house bands, unlike what we have today, you know, where there is no live music. There were remotes, you know, from practically all the nightclubs in New York.
Thank you.
Lutz Bowman, CBS Vice President of Personnel before his retirement, also came to New York from Philadelphia at the request of William Paley to work in the new enterprise. Lohman recalls those early days.
One of the first trial and error periods for broadcasting in general was pressures from labor unions and how to handle them, and in particular from the musicians' union, who were very strongly led by Petrillo. At one point in negotiations in the 30s, I went to see him, and he met me at the train. We talked on many occasions in an armored car. It was during the rough 30s, and a car rode ahead with the armed men. He was somewhat fearful, I presume, of his own situation. Certainly no concern of his as to mine. And I found out after he just had done it as kind of a gag. He thought it would be maybe impressive, but more than that, that it would have influence for the negotiations that were to come.
The Benny Goodman Quartet was heard regularly on CBS, and eventually Goodman had his own program called Benny Goodman Swing School. The quartet were Goodman himself, Lionel Hampton, and Gene Krupa, with Teddy Wilson at the piano.
Teddy Wilson, and this is the first Negro to be hired, in my recollection, on any basis of our thinking in terms of doing something about blacks. And we were aware of the problem and wondering about how to best go about it, but not terribly intelligent. It was John Hammond who first called me and said, "You know that you don't have one black man in your orchestra." And I said, "What do you suggest?" He said, "Well, I get just a few, certainly start with one very good one. I think I could get Teddy Wilson." So we put Teddy Wilson on, and from that, we sort of eased into the business of thinking in terms of doing much more about Negroes.
I can't give you anything but love, baby. That's the only thing I've plenty of, baby. Dream a while, scheme a while, you're sure to find happiness. And I guess, well, all those things you always find for. Gee, I'd like to see you looking swell, baby. Diamond bracelets, Woolworth doesn't sell, baby. Till that lucky day, I know darn well, baby.
The Mills Brothers hitchhiked to New York from Cincinnati in 1932, auditioned for Columbia, and were promptly put under contract. As the 1930s drew to a close, a world war was about to erupt in Europe. The years to come were important years of development for music on CBS Radio, and we'll turn to them next.
You are listening to CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound. And now, Bill Schallert for General Electric.
What we call radio today is nothing at all like what radio used to be. Back around the turn of the century, radio was not the sound of the human voice. Radio was nothing but dots and dashes. Morse code, that's all that radio could send out. But in 1906, something happened that changed all that. It happened in a little Massachusetts town on the Atlantic coast, Brant Rock. And if you stand on the beach in Brant Rock today, it's not hard to look out over the ocean and imagine just how exciting that event must have been. Christmas Eve, 1906. Out on the Atlantic, ship's wireless operators were doing what they always did, listening to the dots and dashes that flew through the air. Then, suddenly, their earphones were filled not with the sounds of dots and dashes, but the sound of a human voice. What they were hearing was the very first long-distance radio broadcast of the human voice, the voice of Dr. R. Fessenden. It came from an antenna in Brant Rock. And one of the men who made it possible was a General Electric engineer named Ernst Alexanderson. Working up at the General Electric Labs in Schenectady, Alexanderson had developed a device called the high-frequency alternator. It was Alexanderson's alternator that first helped send the human voice out into the air. Today, airwaves are full of the human voice. The police, aviators, astronauts, people like me on programs like this. In fact, broadcasting has become so commonplace that you can broadcast your own voice from your own car or your own home. No, radio is nothing at all like what radio used to be. And the progress that's been made from early wireless to today's sophisticated equipment, well, General Electric had quite a hand in that. Progress for people from General Electric.
Continuing with the first of 3 hours of our CBS News special broadcast, CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound, here is correspondent Walter Cronkite reporting on music in the life of CBS Radio. Frank Stanton, president of CBS for 25 of its most crucial years before he retired, remembers the impact of the war on CBS, not just its musical programming, but entertainment programming in general.
I suppose that the radio network really came into its own after World War II, when we went very heavily into doing our own programs. Up until that time, almost all of the programs in the schedule were produced by outside organizations, bought by the advertiser, delivered to us by the advertising agency, and the advertiser was really in control of the schedule. When Mr. Paley came back from the war, he seized that opportunity to embark upon the development of our own programs, which would be owned by the company and sold to the advertiser. With that one concept and the implementation of it, network radio changed from an advertiser-dominated medium to a broadcaster-dominated medium.
The war years made radio even more valuable to its listeners, not only for information about the war, but for its entertainment, especially popular music, which kept morale high. A regular in the war years was
the music of Andre Castellano. Tonight we present Fiesta, a Latin American musical fantasy. We're on our way. Here's Malagueña, as Andre Castellanet sees it.
Another popular program was Your Hit Parade, which the Columbia Network recreated in Spanish for broadcast to Latin America by its shortwave network, which it established in 1940.
Y finalmente, nuestra campeona suprema en el desfile de las canciones campeonas del momento popular. Con nuestra primera estrella al micrófono, la sin par Joan Edwards, escuchemos la canción que esta semana vuelve a ocupar por el aplauso unánime de la juventud norteamericana, el primer puesto del Hit Parade. El amor lo puede todo. Oh, what it seemed to be.
It was just a neighborhood dance. That's all that it was. But oh, what it seemed to be. It was like a royal affair with everyone there. 'Cause you said, yes, I do.
Para toda América Latina, el original Hit Parade volverá al aire de hoy en 8 días con sus artistas de costumbre. Joan Edwards, Joe Dosh, los Hit Paraders, Johnny Mercer y la orquesta del maestro Mark Warno. Y al micrófono, su amigo de siempre, José Santos Quijano. la libertad y solidaridad continental, la cadena de las Américas, Columbia Broadcasting System.
Other CBS musical headliners then and after the war as well were the orchestras of Glenn Miller, Guy Lombardo, Wayne King, and Vaughn Monroe, the Dorsey Brothers, and Woody Herman. There also was Spike Jones, whose orchestra had an entirely different sound. Popular singers also were featured in these years with programs of their own, among them a newcomer who was the idol of the Bobby Sox set. They swooned whenever he sang. His name, Frank Sinatra. And here he is with the Andrews sisters, Patty, Maxine, and Laverne, in a CBS broadcast called Songs by Sinatra.
That's me. Neighbors, you're probably not planning a trip to New York in the very near future, at least, so the Andrews sisters and I would like to give you a rapid look-see at life on the stage of the Paramount Theater. Girls, the overture.
Here we are at the Paramount, 44th and Broadway, more shows than we can count.
You can say that again.
More shows than we can count.
Yes, sir. That skedoodle at the Paramount is mighty rugged. So you wander out on the stage and you start moaning. Kiss me once, and kiss me twice, and kiss me once again. It's been a long, long time.
But never a long, long time between shows. Right, Laverne?
I'll say so, Maxie. By noon, I'm so worn out that I feel like an old mop.
Well, you sure got the hair for it.
I stepped out on the wings expecting the giant spotlight. Nobody even lit a match. The Andrews sisters, were still on stage. They had been there all night giving encore.
Do you hear that whistle down the line? I think that it's engine number 49. She's in. I'm glad I found that way. All the accident began in Santa Fe.
Hey, spotlight, hey. Okay, so I'll sing it in the dark. I fall in love too easily. I fall in love too fast. We have the right atmosphere, you notice?
No kidding.
I fall in love.
That sounds like Frankie Sinatra.
Terribly hard.
Why,
fall
yes.
Up to ever.
And I, Laverne, looking as radiant as a radiator.
Say, Frankie, what songs are you going to be doing?
Well, maybe things like The One I Love Belongs to Somebody Else. That's why she sings her songs for somebody else.
Frankie, are you going to do any of those swell tunes from How Many Times Have You Seen Anchors Away?
Well, I thought I might do I pleaded.
But I, Laverne, played hard to get.
You mean hard to get rid of.
But, Frankie, getting back to reality, I thought we got out of that mix-up pretty gracefully, didn't you?
Well, naturally, I dressed up like the Fourth Andrews sisters. We did a buck and wing and shuffled off the Paramount stage singing. If you're hot beneath the collar, go down, see my sponsor.
My mother's three daughters working for the Yankee Dollar.
If you don't mind, we'll run along, but we'll be back to sing a song.
Sinatra, he will sing real sweet.
While you three birds go
tweet, tweet, tweet. We love our sponsors.
From the beginning, CBS programming included serious music, chamber and church music, symphonies and grand opera, and a program called Invitation to Music, which featured original compositions. But perhaps the most remembered were broadcasts of the New York Philharmonic, heard Sunday afternoons from 1930 to 3. Music, all kinds of music, has been an integral part of CBS radio programming from the start and remains so today with such continuing broadcasts as the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. But in recent years, the emphasis has shifted to news and informational programming. We'll have our first look at that next.
You are listening to CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound. And now Bill Schallert for General Electric.
If you'd like to take a short walk through an exciting piece of the past, a good place to do it is in Speedway, Indiana. Out by the racetrack, where they run the 500-mile race every Memorial Day, is the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Hall of Fame. It's not just a museum of old race cars. It's really a museum of advanced engineering. Because each year, the cars designed for the Indy race represent the absolute limits of engineering at that time. No money or brains or time are spared to put together what the builders hope will be that year's winning car. In 1925, the winning car was a Duesenberg. That car's in pieces now, waiting to be restored and put on display in the Indy Museum. And when it is, you'll be able to see the device that helped it win, a supercharger built by General Electric. Funny thing, that supercharger wasn't designed for a race car at all. It was designed a few years earlier to set another kind of record, an aviation altitude record. And it succeeded. Took a plane up to what was then the amazing height of 34,000 feet and made aviation history. Around the same time, GE came up with some other remarkable aircraft equipment, like a radio altimeter that used radio waves to tell pilots how high the plane was, and the electric compass, a device that could actually help fly the plane. Today, GE's contribution is even more spectacular. The mighty GE CF6 jet engine now powers airlines in some 29 nations and is setting records for economy and efficiency. It's odd that the supercharger, which once set records in the air, should come to rest in a museum dedicated to records on the ground. But good engineering is seldom limited to any one place or any one use. It's needed wherever people want to make progress. Progress for People from General Electric.
You are listening to CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound, a special CBS News broadcast. CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite continues with the first of 3 hours of this anniversary special.
In 1927, when network broadcasting first began at the Columbia Broadcasting System, the majority of its programming was entertainment, much of it a wide variety of music, as we've heard. But in 1930, a newspaper man named Edward Klauber from the New York Times was hired to guide in the development of journalism at Columbia Broadcasting. The election of Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1932 was the first big news event covered by radio.
This is Robert Trout at our election headquarters in the newsroom in New York. The results of the 1932 election now appear to be certain. The ticket of Roosevelt and Garner has won a clear-cut majority over the Republican ticket of Hoover and
Clinton. That night in 1932, radio broadcast the election returns and scooped the newspapers reporting Roosevelt's victory. At that moment, the newspaper extra became an anachronism, as CBS's first news director, the late Paul White, is quoted as saying. But that first on radio triggered a radio press war, a dispute that cut all radio networks off from the use of the press wire services for the next 2 years. William Dunn, today a public relations executive, was writing and editing Columbia's air copy then, and he remembers the radio press war.
Back in the early 30s, the press associations refused to sell news to us. They just wouldn't let us in on the thing. So, White, Abe Schechter, and several others like that got together and organized their own news service. And CBS had a pretty fair little news service going with correspondents in Washington, Chicago, several of the key places. It was effective enough that the press associations got worried. So they agreed to set up an outfit called Press Radio News, which all the press associations contributed to, and they furnished the networks with a certain amount of canned news every day.
In 1933, General Mills agreed to sponsor the Columbia News Service, and within a month, CBS had some 600 correspondents and stringers covering the news in major American cities, but not yet overseas. And then the first regularly scheduled daily newscast began. 5 minutes at noon and at 4:30 in the afternoon, and 15 minutes at 11 in the evening. By the close of the decade, Robert Trout and the late H.V. Kaltenborn were well-known broadcast news analysts on CBS Radio, Trout reporting from Washington on the new president and his new deal. Recently, Trout, who now lives in Spain, recalled President Roosevelt's first fireside chat for CBS News.
After the March 4th inauguration, the banks were closed. The country seemed to be in a rather bad way. Lots and lots of people were terribly depressed. Everybody was worried. People were questioning. Nobody knew what was going to happen. It was really a rather touchy time. And the president announced that he was going to make a talk from the White House to explain just what was going on and why the banks were closed and why nobody could cash a check and why, even if you had a job, you probably didn't have any money to eat on. The White House just said that there was to be a talk by the president. So at the CBS Washington offices, we prepared two introductions for me to use to put the president on the air. The man who actually thought of the phrase fireside chat was Harry Butcher, who at that time was the director and the general manager of CBS's Washington station. It was his idea that this would be just the kind of folksy touch that might do for the introduction for the president. And the whole little introduction was about the president is going to talk to you just as if he had come into your home and sat down beside the fireplace in your living room and gave a sort of fireside chat. It was that kind of introduction. So we sent both introductions over to the White House for the president to choose, and a little while later, Marvin McIntyre, the president's secretary, telephoned Harry Butcher and said, oh, the president likes that folksy one, and so I used it.
H.V. Kaltenborn, like many others in the early days, had been a print journalist before coming to CBS.
Good evening, everybody. There has been a contest of wits between the president of the United States.
Known as the dean of radio news analysts, Kaltenborn gained a national reputation for his round-the-clock reports of the Munich crisis in September of 1938, following the annexation of Austria in March, another radio news event.
All over, wherever you went, you saw people carrying radios because they were listening to the crisis and didn't want to lose a minute of it. That for the first time, the entire country was aware of the fact that the actions of one of these dictators operating over there in Europe could plunge this country into a world war.
The annexation of Austria not only changed the course of world politics, but changed the coverage of news as well. Ned Kalmer, a writer and a CBS newsman for almost 30 years before his retirement, remembers.
To cover that story, CBS put together the first World News Roundup, which I later anchored in New York, with hastily hired correspondents in London, Paris, Berlin, Rome, and Washington. And from then on, CBS Radio News just grew and grew, outgrowing the broadcast pattern that required mellow-toned announcers to read the news and in their place put men who knew what they were talking about, wrote their own scripts, ad-libbed knowledgeably when necessary, were ready to go on the air in emergencies with the requisite background to analyze and explain the situation, whatever it might be.
CBS News director Paul White was one of the first at Columbia Broadcasting to foresee the need for building a more extensive news operation to cover the story of the century, as some called it, that was about to engulf the world. In 1937, he'd sent Edward R. Murrow to London and later sent William Dunn to the Pacific.
White was convinced that we were just one step ahead of a war in the Pacific, and nobody was doing anything about it. He said, "Bill, I want you to go to the Far East for us." And I went out and I set up correspondents in Manila, in Hong Kong, Tokyo, Chongqing, Singapore, Batavia. I think that was it.
In Europe, Ed Murrow, who was named CBS's European director, did the same. Again, Ned Kalmer.
As war broke and spread to the world, Ed put together the famous European staff of war correspondents who came to be known in the trade as the Murrow Boys, and included Charles Collingwood, Eric Severide, Howard Smith, Bill Downs, Larry Lesueur, and later such names as Winston Burdett, Alex Kendrick, David Schoenbrunn.
At home, newsmen H.V. Kaltenborn and Robert Trout, along with John Daly, Quincy Howe, and Quentin Reynolds, reported and analyzed events of the time. One among them was unsurpassed when it came to writing analyses, some of the briefest and most brilliant, Kalmer says, he ever heard. His name was Elmer Davis.
I have striking recollections of Elmer at 485 Madison, his total serenity when all hell was breaking loose in the newsroom, and the way he used to sit calmly in a corner waiting to go on the air while reading the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Whatever the terms imposed on France may be, it can pretty safely be assumed that they will be such as to make it impossible for France ever to become dangerous to Germany again, unless, of course, Hitler should be overthrown. How much farther they may go in the direction of attempting to make France over on the Nazi model remains to be seen, but at least some of the Nazi theorists seem to have extensive hopes. One of the chief of these philosophers of Nazism, a man who has worked out its doctrines very thoroughly, is Alfred Rosenberg. He is a less prominent figure than he used to be, but he still writes a good deal in the Felkischer Beobachter, the principal Nazi paper, and some remarks of his quoted in the New York Times last Sunday are a suggestion of the sort of world that the more philosophical Nazis will create if they can. Mr. Rosenberg writes about Paris. "The fall of Paris," he says, I quote, "the fall of Paris is the beginning of the end of the spiritual and racial turpitude of Europe, for Paris was the center of the mental confusion that pervaded Europe," end quote. What Rosenberg and the other Nazis call mental confusion, and they mean this quite sincerely, it's part of a well-thought-out philosophy, what they call mental confusion is what the rest of us call freedom of thought, the liberty of the mind to work over everything and come to its own conclusions.
Eric Severide covered the fall of Paris.
The life just simply ran out of the city. It was like a beautiful woman lying in a coma, you know, with her lifeblood just draining out from every vein, every street.
Then William L. Shirer, the French surrender to Hitler.
"The Frenchman under Marshal Foch's Pullman car, standing there a few feet from us, in Compiègne Forest. Hitler and the other German leaders rise from their feet as the French enter the drawing room. Hitler, we see, gives the Nazi salute."
The surrender took place in the same Pullman car in which the Germans had surrendered to the Allies in World War I. In 1941, the United States entered the war. CBS had 65 correspondents covering Europe, Asia, and Latin America, reporting mostly by shortwave. In the first year of the war, Columbia operated for more than 6,000 hours and provided over 4,000 broadcasts of war news and analyses. Here's how some of those wartime reports sounded. First, Elmer Davis, and then Robert Trout.
"Great Britain went to war against Germany today. 25 years and 30 days from the time she entered the war of 1914 against the same enemy. France is expected to follow suit within the next few hours.
Great Britain has begun the evacuation of its mothers and children, its crippled and its blind. 3 million of those too weak to fight or to help are being moved from the so-called target areas of the large cities to sanctuaries in the British countryside. It is the greatest mass migration in all history. Now, to give you a first-hand account of this evacuation, Columbia calls in London and hears from Mr. Jolie de Lobigny, head of the outside broadcast department of the British Broadcasting Corporation. We take you now to London.
There are number 12 platforms at Waterloo Station, one of the 10 big metropolitan stations that are engaged today on the evacuation of London's school children. The train's in, and the children are just arriving. I'd like to try and find one of the teachers who's going with them.
Yes.
Are you going with them?
Yes.
Tell us now how many you've got to look after here.
I've got 141 children and 16 people helping. They've come from one of the poorest districts in London, very near the famous Elephant and Castle, which no doubt many people have heard. They're all merry and bright. We haven't had a single child crying. And now I think really in my heart they're looking forward to this little adventure because many of them have never seen the country before. We're very grateful for all that's been done for us. And to all those who've helped us, we say thank you from the bottom of our heart.
1 minute, the train's leaving in 1 minute, is it? Well, now, children, come on, give them a song as you go.
Come on now.
The war spread. Pearl Harbor was attacked by Japan, bringing the United States into the war. Hitler fought on two fronts, west toward England and east into Russia. There were two turning points. The Battle of the Bulge, a last-ditch attempt by the Germans to stop the Allied advance in Europe in 1944, along with the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, Japan, the next year. First, Richard C. Hodlitz reported the Battle of the Bulge in Belgium.
It's icy cold on the front tonight, and the mud on the roads and in the fields is frozen hard in wrinkles and folds. The men, digging new positions in the fields, have had to chop at the ground with their shovels and use axes. And over all, over ruined buildings and corpses and the wrecks of tanks and trucks, over everything, this late December chill has thrown a pattern of frost. Out in the forward position, men are lying in holes, beating their hands together, stamping their feet to get warm. And the ones who are in houses and cellars with stoves and something to burn know how lucky they are. It's mainly behind the line that you realize we're building up for one of the greatest battles to be fought on any front in this war. The men on our front are completely alert. Guns are at the ready with shells half rammed into their breeches. They're waiting for the German attack, the next big attack.
We saw what had happened. What had been Hiroshima was a white mountain of smoke, and when we saw it first, it was already up to 25,000 feet. About 1,000 feet off the ground, it looked like boiling dust. It extended over most of the city, churning down there. And the center of the impact was in the center of the city. And the boiling continued several minutes as we watched. Then the mushroom of smoke broke off, and another developed below it. This one bomb is the equivalent of a 2,000 B-29 raid. This is Webley Edwards at Guam. I return you to New York.
After 6 long years, hostilities ended and the Germans and Japanese surrendered. Charles Collingwood and Robert Trout covered those events.
About 2:30 in the morning, General Tui Spatz walks in. He is followed in quick succession by the Russians. Then Air Marshal Robb comes in, Admiral Burrow. Pretty soon, Beetle Smith himself enters, the man who bore the brunt of the long hours of negotiation. Then the Germans come in. Yodel's face is like a death mask, drawn, unnatural-looking, and with every muscle in it clenched. They reach the table, bow in unison, and wait. General Smith motions them to sit down. Everyone sits down. Yodel signs the surrender at 2:41, and then General Smith, who hands it to the Russian General Soslaparov, and finally the French General Seves, signs it. By 2:45, the last signature has been affixed. Then came the most dramatic moment of all. Everything had been signed. There was no longer any possibility of quibbling or evasion. The German Third Reich, which had once made the world to tremble, had collapsed in blood-stained fragments. Colonel General Yodel, Chief of Staff of the German Army, asked General Beetle Smith's permission to speak. He stood up stiffly, like a man holding himself in against some unbearable pain. In a strangled voice, like a sob, he said, "With this signature, the German people and the German armed forces are, for better or worse, delivered into the victor's hands. In this hour, I can only express the hope that the victor will treat them with generosity." When General Yodel sat down after that, it was all over.
7 p.m. Eastern Wartime. Bob Trout reporting. The Japanese have accepted our terms fully. That's the word we've just received from the White House in Washington. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War. The United Nations, on land, on the sea, in the air, and to the four corners of the earth, are united and are victorious.
No history of CBS News could be complete without its most notable war correspondent, the late Edward R. Murrow.
This is London. History has been made too fast over here today. First in the early hours this morning came the news of the British unopposed...
His reports from London in the war years, from places such as the liberated Buchenwald concentration camp, are considered masterpieces of radio journalism.
As I walked down to the end of the barracks, there was applause from the men too weak to get out of bed. It sounded like the hand clapping of babies. As we walked out into the courtyard, a man fell dead. Two others, they must have been over 60, were crawling towards the latrine. I saw it, but will not describe it. In another part of the camp, they showed me the children, hundreds of them. Some were only six. One rolled up his sleeve, showed me his number. It was tattooed on his arm. D-6030 it was. The others showed me their numbers. They will carry them till they die. The children clung to my hands and stared. We crossed to the courtyard. Men kept coming up to speak to me and to touch me. Professors from Poland, doctors from Vienna, men from all Europe. Men from the countries that made America. We proceeded to the small courtyard. There were two rows of bodies stacked up like cordwood. They were thin and very white. Some of the bodies were terribly bruised, though there seemed to be little flesh to bruise. Some had been shot through the head, but they bled but little. It appeared that most of the men and boys had died of starvation. They had not been executed. But the manner of death seemed unimportant. Murder had been done at Buchenwald. I have reported what I saw and heard, but only part of it. If I have offended you by this rather mild account of Buchenwald, I am not in the least sorry.
I teach my students by using some of Murrow's broadcasts. He was an original. Combination, though, of being able to hold an audience, be serious, never see his likes again.
Fred W. Friendly, former CBS News president, longtime colleague of Murrow and producer for many Murrow broadcasts. After the war, Murrow came home to find that a hot war had turned to a cold one. In the 1950s, he focused on the late Republican senator from Wisconsin, Joseph McCarthy. One of Murrow's reports about McCarthy underscored the cross-currents of feeling in the country in those days.
No one familiar with the history of his country can deny that congressional committees are useful. It is necessary to investigate before legislating. But the line between investigating and persecuting is a very fine one, and the junior senator from Wisconsin has stepped over it repeatedly. His primary achievement has been in confusing the public mind as between the internal and the external threats of communism. We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law. We will not walk in fear one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason if we dig deep in our history and our doctrine. And remember that we are not descended from fearful men. Not from men who feared to write, to speak, to associate, and to defend causes that were for the moment unpopular. This is no time for men who oppose Senator McCarthy's methods to keep silent, or for those who approve. We can deny our heritage and our history, but we cannot escape responsibility for the result. There is no way for a citizen of a republic to abdicate his responsibilities. As a nation, we have come into our full inheritance at a tender age. We proclaim ourselves, as indeed we are, the defenders of freedom wherever it continues to exist in the world. But we cannot defend freedom abroad by deserting it at home. The actions of the junior senator from Wisconsin have caused alarm and dismay amongst our allies abroad and given considerable comfort to our enemies. And whose fault is that? Not really his. He didn't create this situation of fear. He merely exploited it, and rather successfully. Cassius was right. The fault
Dear Brutus, he's not in our stars, but in ourselves. Good night and good luck.
The post-war period brought Harry S. Truman to the White House after the death of Franklin Roosevelt in April of 1945. Truman tried to hammer out the principles of a lasting peace with other major powers, but peace proved elusive. Russia and the Western powers were in constant friction as to where their spheres of influence began and ended. Some called it a conflict of interest between two opposing systems. In 1946, Winston Churchill, Britain's wartime prime minister, described the Russian post-war behavior in this famous passage in a speech broadcast on CBS radio and delivered in Fulton, Missouri.
From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere. And all our subjects, in one form or another, not only to Soviet influence, but to a very high and in some cases increasing measure of control from Moscow. Whatever conclusions may be drawn from these facts, the facts they are, this is certainly not the liberated Europe we fought to build up, nor is it one which contains the essentials of permanent peace.
President Truman fought back with the Truman Doctrine, a doctrine that established a pattern for U.S. foreign policy lasting a generation. In 1947, the Truman Doctrine called for the United States to pump $400 million in economic and military aid to governments threatened with communist takeover.
I believe that we must assist free peoples to work out their own destinies in their own way. This is a serious course upon which we embark. I would not recommend it, except that the alternative is much more serious.
A few months later, the Marshall Plan was instituted, an unprecedented aid program designed to restore the economies of European countries devastated by the war. By 1948, the Cold War was in high gear, and it was reported in all its aspects, domestic and foreign, by CBS News. The Russians blockaded Berlin, isolating that capital city from the West. And for 328 days, the Allies flew in food and material to the partitioned city. In 1949, the Soviets developed their own atomic bomb, and the dispute between East and West deepened. In 1950, the United States was involved in war again. Limited war, but war nevertheless. Soviet-trained troops from North Korea attacked South Korea, and United Nations troops, 90% of them Americans, were dispatched by President Truman to go overseas to fight again. It was a new war in a new place, reported on CBS radio, and a new generation of correspondents. George Herman, Robert Pierpoint, Robert Shackney, Dallas Townsend, and others. General Douglas MacArthur was put in charge of the Korean campaign and urged the president to take the fight north into China itself. Mr. Truman declined, fearing that this action could start World War III, and MacArthur expressed his dissent in public. He was fired by the president. When MacArthur returned to this country, he addressed a joint session of the Congress in a moving speech heard on CBS radio on April 19, 1951.
I am closing my 52 years of military service. When I joined the Army, even before the turn of the century, it was the fulfillment of all my boyish hopes and dreams. The world has turned over many times since I took the oath on the plane at West Point, and the hopes and dreams have long since vanished. But I still remember the refrain of one of the most popular barrack ballads of that day, which proclaimed most proudly that old soldiers never die. They just fade away. And like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away. An old soldier who tried to do his duty as God gave him the light to see that duty. Goodbye.
One noteworthy addition to the CBS News staff in these years was veteran news personality Lowell Thomas. In the late 40s, he returned to CBS, where he had started in 1930.
From Salisbury, Rhodesia, from Islamabad, Pakistan, and from Juneau, Alaska, comes today's news. Good evening, everybody. This is Lowell Thomas. At Louisville,
President... In 1976, after 46 years in broadcasting, Thomas retired. Lowell Thomas was listened to as much for what he said and the way he said it as for the news headlines he reported. His nightly newscast of 7 was the longest-running program of any kind on radio.
When I started and took Floyd Gibbons' place, I had all the air of the world to myself alone. Seems impossible. Both here and in the rest of the world, I had the only daily news broadcast anywhere in the world. Radio is just as potent as ever. It's... The form is a little bit different. Of course, radio doesn't have the monopoly that it had in those early years when I was on the air. But it still reaches out to the ends of the earth and is heard by billions and billions of people.
Radio went on, and so did the development of other aspects of CBS broadcasting. We'll continue the story shortly with a look at entertainment on CBS Radio. I'm Walter Cronkite, CBS News.
CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound, a three-hour CBS News special broadcast. Here is correspondent Walter Cronkite to continue our report.
We're one-third of the way along the way in our review of the many-sided history of CBS Radio. It all began just 50 years ago today, on September 18th, 1927. We've already looked back on two major aspects of that history, the variety of music heard on the network over the years, and the first 25 years of CBS News up to the year 1952. Entertainment on old-time radio was made up of many different sounds. Kate Smith.
When the moon
The sound of children talking to Art Linkletter.
Where does a good fairy get money to put under the pillow?
From a TV show.
Hedda Hopper giving the news and gossip of Hollywood.
At the Stage Door Canteen last night, our own Hollywood star, Jimmy Cagney, was MC. Phil Baker was there with his accordion.
Steve Allen at the piano. One of the best sounds of all on old-time radio was the sound of an audience laughing, being entertained. Jack Benny once described radio as a less confining medium than television.
Instead of a big, ugly glass picture tube, you saw the performers in your own mind. You painted your own big-as-life version of each moment with that loving, creative brush we call imagination.
For those who remember old-time radio, and equally for those who don't, we're on an odyssey back to those days to listen again to some of the sounds on CBS radio over the last 50 years, sounds that entertained.
And now Bill Schellert for General Electric.
Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow. And everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go. The words in that nursery rhyme I just read were the first spoken words ever to be recorded. A recording made by Thomas Edison, one of the founders of the General Electric Company. And with that recording, the phonograph was born in 1877 at Menlo Park, New Jersey. Edison had a staff working for him then, the Insomnia Squad, he called them. They would work around the clock, stopping just long enough to grab a bite to eat or take a short nap. One of the members of this squad was a brilliant craftsman named John Cruzy. Edison had given him a rough sketch. Edison asked Cruzy if he could build it. He said, "Sure, what is it?" "It's a phonograph," Edison said. "What's it supposed to do?" Edison said it would record the human voice and play it back. The response to that was laughter. But the laughter turned to amazement after Edison demonstrated his new invention by recording and playing back the little nursery rhyme. The start of the phonograph was the start of something unique. For the first time in history, the average person could be entertained by famous and talented artists right in his own home. During this time, GE was working on the development of a broader field of entertainment for the home, radio. Soon, America was listening to comedy, drama, and news, in addition to music. And in the early 20s, GE was working on the biggest breakthrough of all, television. In 1928, General Electric made the very first television broadcast. It's been a long road getting from Mary Had a Little Lamb to Mary Tyler Moore, but it's been one paved with hours of enjoyment and a lot of progress. Progress for people from General Electric.
Now CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite continues his report on entertainment. One part of today's CBS News 3-hour special, CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound.
Old-time radio had spontaneity because it was a live medium in the early days. All the laughter you heard was real, and so were the fluffs and flubs. It was all part of radio. Among the biggest radio headliners who could make listeners laugh loud and long were Amos and Andy and Burns and Allen. George Burns and Gracie Allen started on the Columbia Network in the early 1930s and spent almost 20 years on radio, most of it on CBS. They made the transition to television and are still seen in late-night reruns.
You look worried, Gracie. What's the trouble?
I think too much, George. I'm afraid my brain will wear out.
Really? What do you think about?
Everything. Oh, I'm way ahead of other people. Look at that girl who married Cary Grant. Everybody says, what a smart girl.
Well?
I thought of marrying Cary Grant years ago.
You're thinking every minute.
I come from a family of thinkers. Big thinkers.
The biggest.
My brother Willie is famous for thinking on his feet.
He is, huh?
Sure. When anyone asks him how much 2 and 2 are, he takes off his shoes and thinks on his feet. Yeah.
Amos and Andy went back and forth between CBS and NBC during their radio careers and went on to television, but only briefly. In later years, they were considered controversial by some. But in their heyday, Amos and Andy were the all-in-the-family of their era. Here's a famous episode.
But now, don't get nervous, Andy. That's the mean thing, you see.
Well, you'd get nervous, too, if you was in my place.
I know.
Oh, this is a big thing, Amos.
Yeah. I got the ring now, you know.
Yeah, don't lose that. Now, what has I got to do?
Well, you say I do twice. You say that twice.
Well, why has I got to say it twice?
Well, the preacher asks you two different questions, you see. Then you say I do once, then he asks you another question. Then you say I do again, you see.
Yeah. You're going to be standing there by me, ain't you?
Oh, yeah, I is your best man, son. Yeah, now, don't get nervous, Andy. I know just how you feel, but take it easy.
My legs been acting like they've been made out of rubber.
Wait a minute.
Everything's going all right now, Andy. Don't worry about nothing. Remember, I'm looking out for your interest.
Well, listen, Kingfish, why don't the thing start?
Yeah, well, I do. You will now join hands. I, by virtue of authority vested in me by the state and this church, I now pronounce you...
Amos, I shot.
Andy, you hurt
me. Amos, my arm, my right arm.
Somebody done shot me in the arm.
Get a hold of him. Oh, come on, we're going to take him out here. Awa! Awa!
Listeners argued for months. Did Andy really get married? Well, we're ahead of our story. The beginning of CBS radio did not include such superstars as Burns and Allen and Amos and Andy. That was to come later. It all began, in fact, on this date, September 18th, 1927. A fledgling network of 16 stations went on the air for the first time, with a total of 10 hours to be programmed each week, most of it music and entertainment. The next year, 1928, a young man named William S. Paley came to New York from Philadelphia to run the new company with two thoughts in mind: to provide the best entertainment, news, and sports money could buy, and to make Columbia the number one network in the country. In time, he achieved both aims. By 1935, 8 years after the network's debut, it had grown from 16 affiliates to 97. Its profits that year, after taxes, were almost $3 million, and CBS was beginning to catch up with its competition. One of the reasons was that Columbia was able now to attract some of the top talent, like Major Bowes and his amateur hour.
All right, good evening, friends. We start the dizzy spin of the Wheel of Fortune. Around, around she goes, and where she stops, nobody knows. Now first, Fred Scandan, K-N-D-A-N, North Bergen, New Jersey, popular singer. You work?
No, not yet.
Right into my Have you studied music?
No, I haven't studied
music. What would you like to sing?
I'd like to sing Twilight on a Trail.
All right, let's have it. Fred Camden.
When it's twilight on the trail, and I jog along, the world is like a dream, and the ripple of the stream is my song.
Fred, I'm afraid you're not quite ready yet either. Pretty young, I just got here a little bit.
Major Bowes was a part of a variety of network programming that was impressive in these years. Besides music, drama, and the daytime serials, which we'll look at in other segments of this broadcast, its range was rich and varied. There were quiz shows like Phil Baker's Take It or Leave It, poetry readings with Tony Wands, comedians like Joe Wanna Buy a Duck Penner, Judy Canova, Joey Brown, Eddie Cantor, even Fred Allen before he went over to NBC. Dr. Alan Defoe, the man who delivered the Dion quintuplets, gave advice on child health in a CBS radio series. There was even a series on mouth care. All this besides programs on religion and travel. The Voice of Experience, a program of advice to the troubled, and the Rules of Etiquette from the doyenne of the social graces, Emily Post. The more serious side of life in the 1930s, in the depths of the Depression, was not forgotten. A controversial priest from Detroit named Father Coughlin preached at the CBS radio audience, and a homespun comedian named Will Rogers kidded it. Both were fond of poking holes in Roosevelt's New Deal policies.
Counting all the families of American citizens, there are together 25 million men, women, and children in this nation after 4 years of the New Deal who are forced to eat the black bread of relief. Relief? Relief that has failed to relieve. Although the federal government in these 4 years has spent $10 billion to correct unemployment, and although counties, states, towns, and hamlets has spent $3 billion on the same project to relieve a situation that grew out of the sins of modern capitalism. And as a result of it all, we have accumulated more upon relief. We have accumulated approximately $50 billion of debts, of money poured down the rat hole of civilization. And God knows if we will ever break that immorality down in the minds of those of us who have some sanity left.
The $5 million that they're starting in to spend, we all know that that's too much money. It's too much money to take out and throw away or give away or whatever to do with it. We know that. We all know that. But until we refuse to take some of it and it comes our way, we ain't got much right to holler. Where's the money coming from? We're spending.
Well, I don't know, but just offhand, I'd say it's coming from those that have got it.
No matter what we pay, I don't care whether we pay high taxes, low taxes, medium taxes, or no tax, anything, the yell is always the same, 100%. You know what I mean? We just yell 100%. Of course, we know our government is costing us more than it's worth, but do you know But do you know of any other cheaper government that's running around now? I mean, do you? I mean, if you do, I mean, they'll sell you a ticket there any time. Now you can try Russia. I was over there.
A large number of women's broadcasts filled the network's daytime hours. Two of them were news broadcasts, but with a twist. Kate Smith, an early superstar on the CBS network, and her longtime broadcast associate, Ted Collins, combined his news with her commentary.
It's high noon in New York and time for Kate Smith.
Hello, everybody. The people of the United States preferred to take D-Day seriously and prayerfully. There was no confetti, no wild demonstrations. Instead, thousands of Americans responded to the good news in a much finer and better way. Throughout the country, they trooped to blood donor stations and war bond booths. War bond sales increased. Payroll offices of factories were swamped with bond buyers. Some cities started their fifth war loan drive early and have already sold their quotas. Yes, Americans are rallying behind our gallant armies of liberation storming Fortress Europe. But don't forget for one moment that the war is far from won. So here on the home front this noon, let's renew our determination to do everything we can to speed the day of victory for our fighting men. And now, Ted, what's new?
The Allied Army of Liberation...
The other newscast was equally unusual. Wendy Warren and the News combined news headlines with a soap opera, and it ran on the network for 11 years.
Hello, folks. This is Wendy Warren with news reports from the women's world. But first, here's Douglas Edwards with the latest headlines.
The China war is flaming again today.
Douglas Edwards would then report the news, and Wendy, played by actress Florence Freeman, would give several fashion tips and then make the transition into her complicated life story.
Off the air. No visitors, no phone calls. Well, I'm off to the office, Bill. See you tomorrow.
Bye, Wendy.
Wendy is worried. Her manner is abstracted, her eyes clouded and perplexed.
Still no word from Anto. I was so sure I'd...
Domestic comedy, the situation comedy or sitcom, developed early on the network. Easy Aces, later called Mr. Ace and Jane, was one of the successful early ones. Goodman Ace, one of the most talented and highest paid writers on radio, was master of the deadpan, subtle school of comedy writing. He wrote the broadcast, which starred himself and his wife, Jane, who was famous for her malapropisms.
When Jane and I think of buying something expensive, we talk it over. For instance, when we thought of buying a used car, we found it wasn't what it was cracked up to be.
We thought of buying a used car, but it wasn't what it was jacked up to be.
Even when Jane goes to buy lingerie, I make various suggestions.
Even when I go to buy lingerie, he's very suggestive.
One of us never does anything without letting the other one know.
One of us never does anything without letting me know.
The other night, after a hard day at the advertising agency where I work, I was sitting around reading a paper, and Jane was going over her shopping list for the next day.
Now, let me see if I've got everything down that I want to buy tomorrow. Toothbrush, soap, cleansing cream, mink coat, and lipstick. Anything you need, dear?
I like listening to radio. I used to like to listen, and I think everybody liked to listen to radio because it gave them a chance to see it in their mind's eye. There's a one-inch screen up there that everybody saw Fibber McGee and Molly's closet empty out and heard it through the sound effects, you see. And I think, and for instance, in a radio show, a girl in a pair of jeans and a sweatshirt can say to a guy in a sweatshirt and a pair of jeans can be together, and they put a record on of soft music, and he can say to her, "You're the prettiest girl at this dance," and that only costs nothing. On television, I've been running the thousands of dollars of Japanese lanterns you gotta hang and all that stuff, you know. They make a big production out of that.
After the war, CBS began producing its own situation comedies. Comedies such as
My Friend Irma,
starring Marie Wilson, and Our Miss Brooks with Eve Arden and Gail Gordon.
Jane, the telephone's ringing. Jane, the telephone's ringing. Aren't you gonna answer it? I don't know if it's for me. chance. It's not your nickel.
Hello? I mean, hello? Yes, yeah, she's here. Jane, it's for me. Irma?
You know, if Marconi knew that you were going to use a telephone, he never would have invented it.
Oh, Jane, I'm surprised at you. Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone, not Marconi.
You see, I'm beginning to think like you.
Everybody knows that Marconi invented spaghetti.
On Miss Brooks, starring Eve Arden.
But, Mr. Conklin, I wouldn't suggest that...
To sum up, I would like to read what I have written in this last paragraph. To wit, having observed Mr. Stone's educational methods, I am convinced that his outstanding talent is his ability to eat bananas while hanging by his tail. Believe me, Mr. Stone, these sentiments are dictated by a sense... Eat bananas while hanging by his tail!
The man has obviously taken leave of his senses.
But, sir, if you let me...
And when they return, this matter will be thoroughly investigated. Good day, Miss Brooks.
Miss Brooks, this speech. This isn't the speech I wrote.
I know it now, Mr. Conklin, but I didn't.
I hold you responsible for this entire fiasco. And believe me, Miss Brooks, you have no idea how severe your punishment is going to be.
Oh, yes, I have, Mr. Conklin.
Miss Brooks, where are you going?
Out to get some bananas. There's nothing like hanging by your tail from a flagpole to whip up an appetite.
As the 1950s dawned, the Columbia Broadcasting System had become the number one radio network. And this was due mainly to its array of stars and other talent. William Paley had come back from the war and in the succeeding years signed some of the biggest stars in radio entertainment to CBS contracts. His aggressive pursuit of these entertainers was called by some Paley's talent raids. They resulted in a lineup of talent, some new, some long established, that was hard to beat. It included Bing Crosby, Jack Benny, Amos and Andy, Red Skelton, Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, Lum and Abner, Ozzie and Harriet, Lucille Ball, Gary Moore, Burns and Allen, Arthur Godfrey, and Art Linkletter. Linkletter reigned on daytime radio for 23 years. Listen now to some excerpts from those golden years. Imagine that it's a Sunday night then, after a good weekend. You're in your favorite easy chair. Your head is back, resting comfortably, and your eyes are closed, and you're listening.
Now, Clip, you better can help me. I'll mow you down.
From Hollywood, it's the new Edgar Bergen Hour with Charlie McCarthy. It's Sunday night, and time again transcribed for Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy with Mortimer Sturt, Effie Clinker, Ray Noble, and yours truly, John Heaston. Ladies and gentlemen, judging by the volume of mail, this is the part of the show many of you have been waiting for. Our advice to the lovelorn department. And here tonight to help us is our own expert on romance. Here she is, the next to the last of the Red Hot Mamas, Miss Effie Clinker. All right, Miss Clinker, carry on.
I'd love to if you're game. Oh, that Heaston sends me. Of course, I don't have far to go. Yippee!
All right, yes, yes. Flirting with John Heaston, why, you don't even know him. Would you actually go out with a strange man?
Is there any other kind?
Well, I must say, you're quite a lover.
Oh, yes, I must say so. Yeah.
Do men run after your kisses?
They can barely crawl after they are.
You've never been married, though, have you?
No, I never have, no. I came awfully close to one fellow, but I couldn't get along with his family.
Oh, I see. You almost married.
Yes.
But you couldn't get along with his family.
Well, that's what I said.
Yes, I know.
Yes. What, are you an echo?
No. Well, it's rather sad.
Yes, it was.
When those things happen, it is sad.
Oh, it broke me up.
Yes. What was it? His father that objected?
No, not his father so much.
His mother?
No, I couldn't get along with her.
I see. Well, who was it?
It was his wife.
His wife, I...
McCarthy.
In a little while, you will be married to Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
You know, Charlie, there comes a time in everyone's life when he must learn about certain things.
Yes. Well, what do you want to know, Bergen?
What I'm trying to tell you, Charlie, is that what I'm trying to explain to you, I don't know what you're trying to...
Charlie!
Oh, Marilyn Monroe!
I'm here!
Oh, and you look beautiful.
I'm wearing my wedding dress.
Yeah.
Something borrowed.
Yeah, you didn't borrow enough.
We'll be so happy. Mm. I can see it now.
Yeah.
You and I by the fireplace, in the kettle whistling.
Oh, who can blame it?
Charlie.
Marilyn, my dear, we were made for each other.
Kiss me, Charlie, just to make sure.
Yes, gladly, all right. Still playing our song.
From Hollywood, the Red Skelton Program.
Hey, boy, yeah.
Well, Willie Lumplump.
Yeah?
Hey, Willie, what are you doing here?
Well, let's not get nosy, Bob.
Well, what are you doing in a doctor's office? Are you ill?
No, I come in here to wait for a bus. Really, I came in for a few shots. That's what I come in for.
Well, what kind of shots?
Oh, I'm not choosy, you know. I even brought my shot glass with me.
Willie, why don't you go home and sleep it off?
What, and botch up a whole day's work? Look, I don't know why I even talk to you. Every time I see you, you get to look worse and worse. You just don't look like I've had a lot of queer DTs in my day, but you just don't know.
This is Ken Carpenter. Welcome you to the Bing Crosby Show. Ladies and gentlemen, Bing Crosby.
Now, Ken, if you'll excuse me for a moment, I'd like to present a very unusual and special guest. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, Bob Hope.
Before we go any further, pal, I want you to know that I waited at home all day yesterday for you to drop by with my Christmas presents. You're going to come up with something, aren't you?
I was about to ask you the same thing.
Now, what have you got for me, Scrooge?
Scrooge, that's a nice thing to say.
I want you to know I put a lot of thought into this gift, and I think it's something that you'll cherish forever.
Oh, wonderful. Let's see if I can guess what it is.
Well, it's round, and it has a stone right in the center of it. A ring. It's a peach.
Well, isn't that nice? I'm surprised you can spare the fuzz.
Now, next day...
Just in case anyone cares, I'm Dorothy L'Amour. Do you characters mind if I squeeze in here?
Just move in. I'll do the squeezing.
Down, Balto, down. Johnny, now, duck, ruddy face. The shrimp boats are coming.
Hey, I don't have to worry. They're looking for live bait.
If you two will stop squabbling, I'll give you your Christmas present.
Gee, what did you bring us?
I knitted sweaters for both of you. Here.
Where did you learn to knit? This is only one sweater with four sleeves.
Well, you're always together. Put it on and shut up.
I hope it has a V-neck. I'm in television.
This is really very thoughtful, very sweet of you, Dottie. And Bob, I think the fact that Dottie has brought us a gift poses a little problem.
What problem?
Well, come on, give Dottie her gift.
Oh, yes, I thought you had Dottie's present,
no,
Bing.
No, you've got it.
I have? Now, where did I put that?
Oh, come on, quit stalling. You didn't get anything for me for Christmas, did
That's
you?
That's not true. Go on, Bob, there's only one thing to do.
Oh, all right, all right. Here, Dottie, Merry Christmas.
Oh, isn't that sweet? A peach with a bite out of it.
The CBS Radio Network presents Jack Benny.
Now, let's see.
Well, boss, I've got all the luggage in the car.
Good, come on, let's go. Are you sure all the lights are off and the doors are locked, Rochester?
Yes, sir.
Good. Okay, start the car.
Okay.
Maybe we got a little water in the gasoline.
I'd tell if we had a little gasoline in the water.
Never mind. Try the motor again, will you?
Yes, sir.
See, the motor sounds as though it's going from bad to worse.
Sounds like it's going from here to eternity.
Rochester, don't be funny. Try it once more.
Okay.
The motor's not even catching. Maybe the battery's dead.
Can't be that, Mr. Benny. I put a new battery in yesterday.
A new battery? How much did it cost?
Nothing. I got out of your flashlight.
Try it once more. There you are, Rochester. The motor's going. Back the car out of the garage.
Wait till that crowd gets out of the way.
All right, folks, break it up. Break it up. Beat it. Beat it. Why do they always gather when we try to start the car? You can go, Rochester. They've gone now. Rochester, there's Miss Livingston's house. Put on the brake. That's good, Rochester. You stopped right in front of the house.
Yeah, and it only took us once around the block to do it.
That's a memory of long-gone Sundays those of us of the right age can summon up again. A rehearing of the days when CBS Radio's entertainment lineup dominated the network and the competition. We'll turn next to the story of another noted CBS radio entertainer.
And now Bill Shallert for General Electric.
If you'd like to take a short walk through an exciting piece of the past, a good place to do it is in Speedway, Indiana. Out by the racetrack, where they run the 500-mile race every Memorial Day, is the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Hall of Fame. It's not just a museum of old race cars. It's really a museum of advanced engineering. Because each year, the cars designed for the Indy race represent the absolute limits of engineering at that time. No money or brains or time are spared to put together what the builders hope will be that year's winning car. In 1925, the winning car was a Duesenberg. That car's in pieces now, waiting to be restored and put on display in the Indy Museum. And when it is, you'll be able to see the device that helped it win, a supercharger built by General Electric. Funny thing, that supercharger wasn't designed for a race car at all. It was designed a few years earlier to set another kind of record, an aviation altitude record. And it succeeded. Took a plane up to what was then the amazing height of 34,000 feet and made aviation history. Around the same time, GE came up with some other remarkable aircraft equipment, like a radio altimeter that used radio waves to tell pilots how high the plane was, and the electric compass, a device that could actually help fly the plane. Today, GE's contribution is even more spectacular. The mighty GE CF6 jet engine now powers airlines in some 29 nations and is setting records for economy and efficiency. It's odd that the supercharger, which once set records in the air, should come to rest in a museum dedicated to records on the ground. But good engineering is seldom limited to any one place or any one use. It's needed wherever people want to make progress. Progress for people, from General Electric.
Now again, CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite reporting on entertainment, our special anniversary broadcast, CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound. One of the biggest and most durable star entertainers of radio was Arthur Godfrey, who spent almost every day of 38 years on the air from the 1930s to the 1970s. CBS News producer Andy Rooney wrote for Godfrey and remembers those days.
Godfrey has talked more words to more people than any person who ever lived, because he was on for an hour and a half, simulcast, a phrase we used to use, meaning both radio and television at the same time, for an hour and a half, 5 days a week. He was on an hour Wednesday night, Arthur Godfrey and his friends, which was always one of the top-rated shows, either one, two, or three. And then Talent Scouts was often number one. That was half an hour Monday night. And then there was a Best of Arthur Godfrey, which was just a collection of stuff taken from edited out of the week on half an hour on Saturdays. And nobody could have done it who didn't take it as easily as he did.
Now, in order to understand this career, you have to realize that the last thing I ever had on my mind was stardom when I started out. It never occurred to me that I would be a star ever, any time. I just wanted to be the man who did the best job of doing whatever he was assigned to do. Whether it was describing a parade or a football game or announcing for a program or whatever it was in the beginning. And they gave me that early morning chore of playing the records and telling the time. And it was just that I tried to make it entertaining.
He invented a whole style of radio, and people don't realize how important he was. And some of the people who are still popular owe their style to Godfrey. He invented Jack Parr, who's gone. He invented probably Dave Garraway. He invented Johnny Carson, in a sense.
It occurred to me that the only way you could achieve any longevity in our business was to grow in stature, to grow in interest. And so I tried to learn many different things, and to learn all about a lot of different things, so that I could speak with some sort of authority about them, or at least some familiarity with them, and keep my interests going and growing. And therefore, perhaps I would intrigue some people to stay with me. Then, of course, the big thing that I depended upon always was integrity, because I was positive that the only way in the world a man could sell is to sell himself first. And so I decided that I could be your companion, your confidant, the man upon whom you could... In whom you could place some trust.
He also started this huge trend that no one ever considered possible before, of being disrespectful of advertisers.
says here, Arthur, please announce that there will be a midnight show tonight of the women. And how about the women treating the men to this show? He says, talking about style, wait till you see that gorgeous $250 nightgown that is part of the Technicolor fashion show in the new picture, The Women. Fancy that, paying $250 for a nightie.
Godfrey was a real guy. He was talking to people, not performing in front of them.
What made old-time radio unique by today's standards was that much of it was live entertainment. Generally, the only place today where radio is still live is in the news and information area. And we asked CBS News correspondents Douglas Edwards and Charles Osgood to reflect on the two modes, live and recorded.
I guess the news area in both radio and television today is one of the last bastions of liveness anyway, isn't it?
Exactly, it is, and it's so refreshing, really, to do most of a news broadcast entirely live. Of course, tape is a marvelous adjunct today. It's one of our tools, and it works beautifully. But it, as you know, Charlie, has not always been so. For instance, in my early days at CBS, 1942 forward, we had no recordings, no tape. Everything was live, switches to all kinds of places.
So when you called in a piece from London, London came up.
London was there, and if London was not there, or if the signal in the pre-testing period was not up to standard, I would fill London's part in New York, or we'd switch somewhere else. We usually had, for overseas pickup news programs, alternate spots to go to. Quite often, we would go to a pickup scheduled from Moscow. Now, in the talk-up from the correspondent in Moscow, we would ascertain whether their clock was working the same way the old clock on the studio wall in New York was. Most times it was not. Moscow would be either 5 seconds, 6 seconds fast or slow, or 20 seconds off, which meant in order to switch to them, we had to calculate the error in their clock in order to switch into the correspondent over there for his report. And I must explain one other thing, that the correspondent in Moscow could not hear us from either direction. He went live on a time basis.
That sounds like a mistake waiting to happen. I don't know. I guess we've all made fluffs. And I've personally, Doug, and I'm sure that over the years you must have made one or two.
Oh, heavens, yes. One memorable one for me was on VE night. Over in London, Ed Morrow and I were in the BBC studios, and he did his piece and then switched over. Doug, what have you been doing today? And I said, been broadcasting, Ed. But then I began my piece by saying, yes, indeed, it is VE Day in London. And at which point, a great many people are going to find this a little hard to understand. Edward R. Murrow just dissolved in laughter and disappeared under the table for a moment or two. And I had to finish the broadcast.
Yeah. Doug, that must have been a shade disconcerting. But you must be one of the few people in the whole world who can say that he caused the great Edward R. Murrow to drop under the table.
Entertainment, one of the great contributors to the building of CBS Radio. And in many ways, a broad base for the outpouring of entertainment to come later on television. Next, we'll look at sports on CBS Radio.
You are listening to CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound. And now, Bill Schellert for General Electric.
One of the things that makes a great city great is its heritage, its people, places, and events. And Chicago, with its colorful 140-year history, certainly qualifies as a great city. It was Chicago that hosted one of the most famous sporting events in history, an event that General Electric had a hand in. The place was Soldiers Field Stadium, September 22, 1927. This was the night of the Dempsey-Tunney fight and the disputed long count. 150,000 people, then the largest sports crowd ever, turned out to see Gene Tunney defeat Jack Dempsey for the heavyweight championship of the world. Because the fight was at night, more people who worked during the day could attend. so Soldier's Field had to expand to accommodate almost twice its normal capacity. People were either climbing fences or perched on them to see the fight. And it would have been difficult not to see it, because GE had filled the entire stadium with light. Enough light to equal 300 full moons. All of it specially rigged and installed for the historic bout. That was quite an achievement in its time. The newspapers called it a gigantic spectacle. Others talked of the complete chaos in the stands that could have occurred if it hadn't been for the lights. People who saw the fight described it as having the clarity of day. We've come a long way from what was once thought unusual. Today, there's hardly a place you can go without finding some sort of baseball, football, or basketball game being played under GE lights. And there's ice skating, bowling, rodeos, track meets, sporting events of all kinds. GE has made a lot of progress adding to the hours of enjoyment in a day by adding hours of enjoyment to the night. Progress for People from General Electric.
CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound. Here again is correspondent Walter Cronkite with our CBS News special broadcast marking the 50th anniversary of CBS Radio.
We have so far reported on aspects of news, entertainment, and music in the history of CBS Radio. Now we turn to another memorable area, sports. Sports has become a major force in American life, says James A. Michener in his book, Sports in America. We devote more money and time to sports than most of us realize, and sports consumes much of our listening, viewing, and reading time. Sports coverage on radio is only as good as the people who report it. When the Columbia Phonograph Broadcasting System, as it was then called, first took to the air on a muggy September afternoon in 1927, the 16-station network did not carry a single sports broadcast. But Columbia soon realized how important sports reporting was to attracting audiences and began an all-out effort to cover the regattas, races, games, and other events of interest to its listeners. Early coverage sometimes demanded extraordinary ingenuity, even daring on the part of the reporter, requiring him to cover the event from an airplane or atop a telephone pole to get the story and beat the competition. The same year the Columbia Network began broadcasting, 1927, a young New Yorker with 3 years of broadcasting experience was hired at CBS. He began as an announcer, but soon specialized in sports, and for the next quarter century, he was at the top of his profession and developed a style of sports reporting that set the mold for many who followed. Ted Husing.
Ladies and gentlemen, from the inside to the outside, Jesse Owens on the pole. Lennart Strandberg of Sweden next to him in second lane. Eric Borschmeyer, the German, Borschmeyer. Jesse Owens is running in white shoes today. Ralph is running in black shoes. And here they go, down in the mark. They're set. The gun sounds and they're away. And Jesse Owens comes out of there with Ralph Metcalf. Jesse Owens starts moving. He's a yard or two out in front. Metcalf is coming second up on him. It's Owens, Metcalf, and Ozendorf.
The Ted Husing style was noted for its control and accuracy. Described as being able to bring you to the edge of your chair without screaming, his flow of language was such that Husing rarely needed to use the same descriptive adjective twice. Kentucky Derby of 1939 is an example.
This is Ted Husing speaking from Churchill Downs, the scene of the truest test in America for thoroughbred racehorses. A glamorous, colorful mile-and-a-quarter racing trial for three-year-olds. No sporting event in this country has more appeal than this annual race, which will shortly be contested for the 65th time. And thus it commands a tremendous amount of interest throughout the nation and annually brings a jammed-in crowd of sports followers to the track. Today is no exception. Attracted by the hope of a truly run race by the field of 8 3-year-old thoroughbreds, the best available in the list of 115 nominations, the American race goer has come to Louisville to see the great Bluegrass Classic. Since early in the dawning when the first peep of light descended upon the town, until even now the fans have flocked to the racetrack. It is a scene of riotous color, a park in which thousands beyond count have taken over every available spot from rafter to fence to see the 8 racing machines do their stuff over the tortuous route of the race. Each horse will carry 126 pounds, and that is an impost that will decide a truly good horse when at last his nose splashes under the wire tautly stretched across the track. All the trainers vouch that their charges are in good condition, and when the ablest of the horses reaches the finish, the myriad fans assembled at Matt Wynn's track will roar a lusty huzzah to the winner. Since the time schedule...
Over the next decade, sports reporting became more sophisticated, and gradually the sports caster was invented. No longer were random announcers assigned to cover sports events. Coverage was given to Husing and others who were beginning to specialize in sports reporting. Mel Allen was one of this new breed.
They assigned me as understudy to both Ted Husing and then Bob Trout, so that I was doing special events and sports, as well as station breaks and anything else that staff announcers were supposed to do.
Allen arrived at CBS in 1937, fresh from the University of Alabama Law School, and got a job on Columbia's announcing staff. He had no intention of staying at CBS, or in New York City for that matter, but after a few months realized he liked what he was doing, was making good money doing it, $100 a week, and sensed that radio and sports had a future together. Allen's ability to talk extemporaneously for long periods of time made him a natural for sports broadcasting, and in 1939 he became the voice of the Yankees on CBS radio.
Being with the Yankees was really a highlight because it was part of their great dynasty. DiMaggio was the greatest total ball player that I ever had the opportunity to see. There were many great ones like Willie Mays and Mickey Mantle and Hank Aaron and Roberto Clemente and so on. But as a total ball player, as a great leader, DiMaggio ranks number one. I remember one time when we were on a train traveling from one town to another, Joe had been in a slump. And I went by his bedroom on the train, and he was reading a book. I said, Joe, may I drop in for a moment? He said, yes. Sit down. We got to chatting. And I said, Joe, have you deliberately changed your batting stance? And suddenly he looked at me. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, normally your batting stance is one that has your 2 feet touching the inside corner of the batter's box. Lately, your right foot has been pulled back further. He knit his brows for a moment and looked at me, and he says, are you sure of that? I said, yes. In any case, the next day we were in Cleveland, and he had resumed his normal batting stance, and he hit 3 home runs that day. How about that?
Joe DiMaggio, the Yankee clipper, the total player, also knew when to retire, and in 1951 held a press conference to announce he was bowing out of baseball. CBS radio listeners heard it.
I feel that I have reached the stage where I can no longer produce for my ball club, my manager, my teammates, and my fans the sort of baseball their loyalty to me deserves. In closing, I would like to say that I feel I have been unusually privileged to play all my Major League Baseball for the New York Yankees. But it has been an even greater privilege to be able to play baseball at all. It has added much to my life. What I will remember most in days to come will be the great loyalty of the fans. They have been very good to me.
In the decade of the 1950s, sports was becoming big. Big as a spectacle, big as a business. Walter Lanier Barber, the old redhead, with his easy southern drawl, was one of the leading sports broadcasters, known for telling it like it was. In an interview with CBS News several years ago, Barber talked about his early days in radio.
When you were the broadcaster at a microphone, you were the entire show. And you just tried to talk about what you saw. And one of the exciting things in the early days was the contest that never seemed to end between Graham McNamee and Ted Husing. They were always competing with each other. And one was going to outdo the other. I know that Husing was the first great technician as a sports broadcaster, and he was the soul of pinpoint honesty. I do the work that's given to me to do it as truthfully as I can do it, and if people like it, fine, and sometimes they haven't liked it.
The Columbia Network did like Red Barber's work, and in 1946 made him director of sports for the network. His main concern that year was the coverage of major college football games. That dilemma of trying to report the progress of more than one game led to an innovation in the broadcasting of sports that is now standard practice. That is, covering more than one event at a time. This enabled Barber to report on several important games the same day by linking the different remote locations to New York with open telephone lines. In a matter of minutes, CBS Radio could air on-the-spot reports from different locations around the country. This was a revolutionary concept. Until that time, the unwritten rule had been never leave a game in progress. Also under Red Barber, sports documentaries began to be produced.
The CBS Documentary Unit invites you to play ball, to join a fast-moving tour of that wonderland of heroes, hullabaloo, and high finance known as baseball. But now, here is your guide, Columbia's Director of Sports, Red Barber.
Hello, everybody. It's the old redhead. We're taking the great dream of every American youngster, the dream of playing ball in the big leagues. And we're going to watch, step by step, as that dream comes true for at least one of them. One typical American kid. Finding him wasn't easy. We sifted through the roster of every big league club, ran through hundreds of names and mountains of statistics, until one day we turned the page, and there he was.
Rhys Harold H., shortstop, Brooklyn Club. Bats right, throws right. Height 5'10", weight 170. Born July 23rd, 1919, residence Louisville, Kentucky.
Behind those cold statistics, we found a warm human story. We found Pee Wee Reese, a star and a symbol. His story might well have been yours. It still may be your kid's. It's the way one American boy worked to make his great dream come true. Well, Pee Wee, where would you say ball players come from?
Oh, no special place, Red. Anywhere.
You mean they're even born like anybody else? And not just hatched out on a farm?
That's right, Red.
Well, where were you born, Pee Wee?
In Kentucky. Ekron, Kentucky. That's near Louisville, Red.
And I don't suppose, young man, that you remember the circumstances.
No, sir, I don't.
I suppose I'm the only one who does. I'm Pee Wee's mother. But down here in Louisville, I had Pee Wee in our home in Ekron. When they first showed him to me, he was just like any other baby. He was soft, red, and he squalled like all the rest of them. You couldn't tell if he was going to turn out to be a butcher or a ball player.
As the 1960s dawned, sportscasters began moving away from working exclusively for networks. They often were under contract to a team as well. This was the practice with many baseball clubs. For example, Phil Rizzuto, the New York Yankee shortstop, retired from active play in 1956 and was hired by the Yankees to broadcast their games on both radio and television. The next year, CBS hired him to do a network broadcast called It's Sports Time, which was heard on CBS radio for the next 19 years.
When I got the job, what I liked about it, I never liked to do anything on tape. And in those days, we did everything live. And I'd say, the first 12 years, every show was live. And I loved that because I like challenges. And you had to be right on time and all the cues had to be right. And, you know, if you're fluffed, you had to just keep right on going. I got a big break in two ways with Lowell Thomas. Lowell Thomas kind of liked me and was like a father to me and taught me so much about broadcasting. He got me to enunciate a little more clearly. Being from Brooklyn, a lot of people didn't quite understand what I was saying. And he did it in such a way that it didn't upset me or anything bother me. It was constructive criticism. Plus the fact that I followed Lowell Thomas in about the first 10 years. And a lot of people just wouldn't turn. You know how people are. They got the dial on that one station they want. And so I would get the overflow from Lowell's broadcasts, and it helped me tremendously. And he helped me tremendously in my career.
It's Sports Time with Phil Rizzuto.
Hi, everybody. Over the years, at least during my time, any list of the most respected college football coaches would include Frank Leahy, Red Blake, and Bud Wilkinson. In the professional ranks, there are two who come to mind. George Halas of the Chicago Bears and Paul Brown of Cleveland. The fact that Brown has been dropped as head coach of the organization he hatched from a chick into a full-blown eagle in a very short time following the war and kept it at peak efficiency for so long has nothing to do with the current case.
In the 1970s, the treatment of sports on the network continued to evolve. Now broadcasts had to be short and to cover as much ground as possible. CBS sportscaster Win Elliott developed a style that made the most of the airtime, and for the last decade of CBS Radio's first 50 years, the Elliott sound has been a feature on the network.
In this past decade or so, CBS has been part of an exciting, confusing, and nearly always spectacular world of sports. In baseball, Hank Aaron's record-breaking home run, or Lou Brock's record-breaking 105th steal.
Brock takes the lead. Ruffin checks him. He is going. The pitch is a strike. The throw. He is there. He did it. 105 for Lou Brock.
And the brilliance of the Yankee, Pennant, and World Series teams. In pro football, the Green Bay Packers, Miami Dolphins. And you remember the day O.J. Simpson ran 250 yards and broke Jimmy Brown's single-game record? Some of us thought that record would stick around for a while.
I don't think it's going to last all that long. 250 yards is a big day, but I think somebody's going to come up and get 300 yards one day, and I'd like to be the first guy to get 300 yards.
Gale Sayers, Johnny Unitas, Fran Tarkenton. And as Don Klein saw it happen on October 31st, 1972...
And now George Blando ready. At the threshold of another great milestone in this fabulous career of Blando's, now playing in his 340th NFL game. The ball placed down by Stabler. Kick. Blando has the point. He has scored 2,000 points in his career.
Eventually, 2002. And you remember the American Football League and the New York Jets and the guy who made both of them happen.
New York's the city, man. This is the place.
Broadway Joe, they called Joe Namath.
It's fun, man. You go in Manhattan, people know you, and it's a great city. I wouldn't want to go anywhere else.
But time marched on, and for Joe Namath, it's now Hollywood and Vine. UCLA basketball under John Wooden. Unbelievable 10 NCAA championships in 12 years. And the players, Al Cinder, Goodrich, Wicks, Rowe. And lastly, if not first, a giant redhead who seemed born to play basketball.
I've been playing since fourth grade, and I've just always been able to play basketball.
Bill Walton further proved that by leading the Portland Blazers to an upset NBA championship over the Philadelphia 76ers just this year. Wilt the Stilt, Jerry West, Cousy, Havlicek, and the incomparable Boston Celtics. In tennis, Rod Laver, John Newcomb, Ilya, Jimmy Connors, Billie Jean, 19 Wimbledon crowns for Billy, Chris Everett. And after waiting 25 years for a horse like Secretary to win the Triple Crown, it happens again this year.
Seattle Slough is under a hand right, and he's going to take it all. We're coming to the line. It's Seattle Slough that wins it by two lengths.
And the Preakness.
We're coming to the line, and it's Seattle Slough that wins it by a length and a half.
The Belmont.
There's that finish. Seattle Slough wins by four with Dean Crugier waving his whip as he crosses under the wire.
Undefeated. Unparalleled is the word for hockey's Gordie Howe. At 49, he'd played with his two sons on the same team. Pele arrived, and seemingly so has soccer. And we lost some people in sports, too. Vince Lombardi, and...
I'm the only one left now that was with the Dodgers alive. I'm for the knuckleball pitcher all my life, even if I can't see now. Goodbye.
Casey Stengel's last appearance in public. In golf, there was Jack Nicklaus, Arnie, Gary Player, Miller, Tom Watson now, and thank the Lord there's still Sammy Snead.
I still enjoy playing. When I lose that, why, then I'll hang the shingle out. I've gone hunting or fishing.
Son of a gun, Sammy is now 65. A.J. Foyt's four indies, and of course the new era in sports, exposure, expansion, the new leagues, WHA, ABA, WFL, and that announcement out of Toronto in 1974.
The three of the greatest football players in the world, Larry Zonka, Jim Kick, and Paul Warfield.
And the very next year, the NFL strike. The New England Patriots refusing to play an exhibition game with the Jets.
The team met, and at 3 o'clock they decided to go on strike, and at 3:15 they left Schaefer Stadium, refusing to play tomorrow's game. And the strike thus means that they will refuse to practice.
There was a strike in baseball. Umpires struck. Basketball referees struck. And then the instant millionaires, the free agents, Julius Erving, Andy Messersmith, Reggie Jackson. Nobody knows where it'll end. Like the greatest golf shot in all history. You remember Al Shepard's shot on the moon?
Oh, here we go again. There we go. Ready to die. One more.
Miles and miles and miles and years and years and years. And like I said, Walter, CBS has been a part of an exciting decade in sports. And as we go into the 80s, as far as I'm concerned, it's only the beginning.
To sum up the lot, the life, and the loquaciousness of the sportscaster in covering 50 years of CBS sports, CBS News correspondent Charles Osgood puts it this way.
For many fans, and I am one, sports will never be such fun as once they were when distant cheers fell upon our youthful ears. Those games were of a special kind. The field was laid out in our mind. The cracking of the ball and bat, as by our radios we sat. The pop into a glove or mitt, that thrill of some important hit. At games they carried on the air, the voices made us feel right there. The winning, and sometimes the losing, spelled out by Barber, Allen, Husing. No Summerall and no Jim Kelly yet, but Phil Rizzuto and Win Elliott would give their colorful reports on all the major news in sports. Think back, and you can hear them now. Someone saying, "Holy cow!" And someone else with Dixie Cool saying, "Well, I'll be a suck-egg mule." In victory or in defeat, it was we who sat in the catbird seat. I miss those days, and can you doubt that? You do too? Well, how about that?
We'll continue CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound, with a look at half a century of radio drama. I'm Walter Cronkite, CBS News.
CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound, a special three-hour CBS News anniversary broadcast. Now here again is correspondent Walter Cronkite.
We've come two-thirds of the way along our course, looking back at the various aspects of CBS Radio's first half century, reliving the network's development in music, sports, entertainment, and the early days of news. Radio, as we've noted, developed along many different paths. Another one was drama. Radio drama was a staple of the Columbia Broadcasting Network from the beginning. From those earliest days in 1927, CBS was eager to experiment and to discover new talent. In 1929, 2 years after Columbia became a network, the Columbia Artists Bureau was organized as a CBS subsidiary to manage and supply the network with talent. It also became a training ground for rising radio stars and fostered the creative climate necessary for prestige drama at the network to flourish in the years to come. Drama on CBS Radio, coming up.
And now Bill Schallert for General Electric.
New Yorkers have a saying about New York City. It'll be a nice place, they say, if they ever get it finished. Because like most cities, New York is changing every day. Old buildings coming down, new buildings going up. And in the process, a lot of the past just disappears. Take what's happened on Pearl Street, number 255 to be exact. Today, that address is a parking lot. Tomorrow, some new building will probably go up there. But yesterday, about 100 years ago, 255 Pearl Street was the scene of an event that changed all our lives. For it was on Pearl Street that Thomas Edison built this country's first central power plant. Inside was an electric generator that would provide light for 85 customers. Edison himself switched on the lights for some of those customers. It wasn't a very impressive premiere because the lights went on in mid-afternoon, but by 7 o'clock it was darkening, and all those gleaming Edison bulbs became a marvel indeed. That day on Pearl Street, September 4th, 1882, a revolution started. Year by year it spread. More and more of America became electrified. And General Electric, the company Edison helped start, was building power plants bigger and bigger. The Pearl Street plant had served 85 customers. Half a century later, GE was working on generators that could serve 25,000 customers. And there were bigger yet to come. Too bad that first little power plant on Pearl Street has disappeared. It could be a tourist attraction as big as Fifth Avenue or the Empire State Building. But if you're ever in New York, you might like to go down there anyhow, Pearl Street. If you've got a good imagination, maybe you'll hear the whir of that first little Edison generator. It's a sound that, like the whir of generators today, was a sound of progress. Progress for people from General Electric.
Now again, correspondent Walter Cronkite with our golden anniversary special broadcast on the first 50 years of CBS Radio.
Programs for young people were an early interest of the radio network, an interest that continues today, incidentally, with the CBS Radio Adventure Theater. Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy, one of the longest-running juvenile adventure series, was first heard on the air over CBS in 1933. The next year, Nyla Mack, one of the first women directors, began her 20-year-long drama series for children called Let's Pretend.
Hello, hello, come on, let's go, it's time for Let's Pretend. With magic and with make-believe, our own real special blend. A fairy tale comes true now, from start right to the end. So everyone come join the fun, come on and let's pretend.
Hello, pretenders.
Hello.
Today, how would you like one of the best-known, best-loved stories of all time?
We love it!
All right, then. Let's have Cinderella. Shall we start off to meet her right away?
Well, just as soon as Bill looks at her.
There was something for every taste on the network down the years. Detectives like Mr. Keene and Nick Charles. Thrillers like Suspense and Inner Sanctum. And true-to-life stories with plenty of crime, such as Gangbusters, which made the claim to be the only national program to bring its listeners authentic police case histories.
The CBS Radio Network presents Gangbusters.
On another plane from Gangbusters, there was Lights Out, which was not for the faint-hearted.
Lights Out brings you stories of the supernatural and the supernormal, dramatizing the fantasies and the mysteries of the unknown. We tell you this frankly, so if you wish to avoid the excitement and tension of these imaginative plays, we urge you calmly but sincerely to turn off your radio now.
Any discussion of radio drama would be incomplete without the soap opera. By the late 1930s, there were some 20 daytime series running on CBS. And a 1950 survey reported that more than half of the nation's housewives listened to Ma Perkins and Our Gal Sunday, both CBS programs. The longest running was The Romance of Helen Trent, which was on CBS for 27 years of protracted agony, while holding out the hope of eternal romance to its audience.
Once again, we bring you the romance of Helen Trent, who sets out to prove for herself what so many women long to prove, that because a woman is 35 or more, romance in life need not be over. That romance can live in life at 35 and after.
Daytime dramas also provided what some might call philosophy to live by.
And now, life can be beautiful.
In every age, there is a constant search for, in its larger sense, beauty. Mark Akenside wrote a poem in the early 18th century called The Pleasures of Imagination. And it's this verse. Alas, how faint, how slow the dawn of beauty and of truth breaks the reluctant shades of Gothic night, which yet involve the nations. But perhaps finally, in this, our generation, the goal will be reached, and all nations will come out of the night into a fuller realization that only through understanding life can be beautiful.
The soap operas allowed listeners to indulge their secret fantasies.
Once again, we present Our Gal Sunday. The story of an orphan girl named Sunday who was left on the steps of the cabin of two old miners who raised her from childhood in the little mining town of Silver Creek, Colorado, who, in young womanhood, married England's richest, most handsome lord, Lord Henry Brinthrop. The story that asks the question, can this girl from a little mining town in the West find happiness as the wife of a wealthy and titled Englishman?
Best of all, the soap opera plots were so complex as to provide the audience food for thought until the next thrilling installment.
You? Is anybody?
And now the Goldberg. Molly Goldberg is excited about the matchmaking that she's doing.
With docile and lovely Emma working in the Goldberg house, Molly can think of nothing better than to try to be helpful. Especially since Bruce Hanley, Mary Foote's brother-in-law, has a nice farm and is something or other essential and so on. This pretty and sentimental country romance is Molly's idea, but we know the real side. The curious, almost evil character of Emma and the fascination she exercises on Molly's son. We know how Emma has lied to everyone, fooled everyone, how she has wound herself into Sammy's life like some parasitic vine. And now we know how she is using Molly's cheerful little plan to force Sammy into an open statement. And now, as they stand on the orchard hill overlooking the house.
In a different kind of drama, a milestone was achieved on CBS Radio with the coming of theatrical productions presented in single evening broadcasts. Lux Radio Theater had its debut on CBS in 1935.
Welcome, everyone, to Hollywood and to another hour in the Lux Radio Theater. And now, we present Hollywood's foremost producer, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Cecil B. DeMille. Greetings from Hollywood, ladies and gentlemen. Gary Cooper and Gene Arthur were born to the roles they play tonight. Mandrake Falls, where our play opens, might have been any one of the prairie towns Gary once called home, while the town Mr. Deeds goes to is the town Gene Arthur came from, New York. Now, we present the stars and the story. Ladies and gentlemen, the Lux Radio Theater spotlights Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, starring Gary Cooper.
I just want to see if this thing fits my new bass horn all right.
Mr. Deeds, we have some news for you.
Yeah. I suggest you sit down, though, Mr. Deeds.
Mr. Deeds, does the name of Martin W. Semple mean anything to you?
Not much. An uncle of mine, I think, although I never saw him.
Well, he passed on. He was killed in a motor accident in Italy.
He was? Now, that's too bad. If there's anything I can do...
Mr. Semple left a great fortune when he died. He left it to you, Mr. Deeds. Deducting taxes, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 million.
Well, for crying out loud.
Perhaps you didn't hear me, Mr. Deeds. I said the whole Semple fortune goes to you. $20 million.
Oh, I heard you all right. $20 million. That's quite a bit, isn't it?
Oh, it'll do in a pinch.
Yes, indeed. I wonder why he left all that money to me. I don't need it.
Lux Radio Theater aired for 19 seasons on CBS. Another aspect of serious drama came into its own on CBS Radio in the late 1930s. In 1936, the Columbia Workshop, an experimental theater, was inaugurated. Its 1937 production of Archibald MacLeish's verse drama called Fall of the City is still remembered. Another of the workshop's illustrious presentations was Shakespeare's Richard III.
Today, the Columbia Workshop, radio's foremost laboratory of writing and production techniques, has the honor to present the Old Vic Theatre Company of London, England. Their first radio appearance in the United States, a special hour and one-half arrangement of the tragedy of King Richard III by William Shakespeare, with Laurence Olivier in the role of Richard and Ralph Richardson as the narrator.
If Richard III touches deeper chords of terror than the preceding plays, the reason is not to be found in the greater violence of the historic events it traces, but in the character of Richard himself. Here is Richard.
Since this world affords no joy to me, but to command, to check, to o'erbear such as are of better person than myself, I'll make my heaven to dream upon the throne, and whiles I live to account this world but hell, until my misshaped trunk that bears this head be round impaled with a glorious crown. But yet I know not how to get the crown, for many lives stand between me and home. And I, like one lost in a thorny wood, that rents the thorns and is rent with the thorns, seeking a way and straying from the way, not knowing how to find the open air, but toiling desperately to find it out, torment myself to catch the English crown, and from that torment I will free myself, or hew my way out with a bloody axe. Why? I can smile, and murder whiles I smile, and cry content to that which grieves my heart, and wet my cheeks with artificial tears, and frame my face to all occasions. I'll drown more sailors than the mermaid shall. I'll play the orator as well as Nestor, deceive more slyly than Ulysses could, and, like a Sinon, take another Troy. I can add colors to the chameleon, change shapes with Proteus for advantages, and send the murderous Machiavel to school. Can I do this, and cannot get a crown? But were it further off, I'd pluck it down.
Over the years, certain radio broadcast dramas were unique and are considered classics today. One was
Suspense.
And one of the plays in the Suspense series was called Sorry, Wrong Number. It starred Agnes Moorhead, virtually the only member of the cast, and was the story of an invalid woman confined to bed who overhears her own murder being plotted on a cross telephone line.
Hello?
Hello, is Mr. Stevenson there?
Hello?
Hello?
Hello? Hello, George?
Yes, boss, this is George speaking.
Hello, who's this? What number is this, please?
I'm here with our client.
Oh, good. Is everything set up for tonight?
Well, yes, George, he says everything is set up.
Good.
What number is this, please?
At 11:15, a train crosses the bridge. It makes a noise in case her window is open and she should scream.
Hello?
Remember, George, make it quick. Our client doesn't wish her to suffer long.
Oh. I'll use a knife, then.
Oh.
Police station, precinct 43, Sergeant Martin speaking.
Police department? This is Mrs. Stevenson. Mrs. Albert Smythe Stevenson of 53 North Sutton Place. I'm calling up to report a murder. The murder hasn't been committed yet, but I overheard plans for it over the telephone, over a wrong number that the operator gave me.
Yes, ma'am.
Two men were talking, and they were going to murder some woman at 11:15 tonight. She lived in a house near a bridge. Are you listening to me?
Yes, ma'am.
It's just unnerved me dreadfully, and I'm not well.
Well, we'll look into it, Mrs. Stevenson, see if we can check it with the telephone company.
Check it! Personally, I feel you ought to do something far more immediate and drastic than just check the call. I'd say the whole thing calls for a search. A complete and thorough search of the whole... Yeah, I'm very near the bridge, and I'm not talking... Oh, for heaven's sake, I'm going to draw another line. Hello! Hello, stop ringing me! Do you hear? Answer me! Who is this? Do you realize you're driving me crazy? Who's calling me? What are you doing it for? Now, stop it! Stop it! Stop it! I say, hello! If you don't stop ringing me, I'm going to call the police. You hear? The police! If Albert would only go.
Give me the police department.
One moment, please. I will connect you.
Please. Get the police. Somebody's got to hurry. Get the police, please. Oh, I've got to... What do you want? Oh, don't come near me. Please, I haven't hurt anybody. Please, I haven't... Please don't hurt me. Please, I haven't hurt anything. Ah!
Police department? Sorry, wrong number. Don't worry, everything is okay here.
Norman Corwin's On a Note of Triumph is considered another radio classic. Here's an excerpt of that broadcast, which aired in 1945, just before the end of World War II, and earned CBS 1,000 immediate phone calls of congratulations in New York and more than that number in Hollywood.
By popular request, the Columbia Broadcasting System presents a repeat performance of On a Note of Triumph, a special broadcast written, directed, and produced by Norman Corwin for the Day of Victory. Martin Gable as narrator, and the music is by Bernard Herrmann. Is victory a sweet dish, or isn't it? And how do you think those lights look in Europe after 5 years of blackout going on the sixth? Brother, pretty good. Pretty good, sister. The kids of Poland soon will know what an orange tastes like. And the smell of honest-to-God bread, freshly made and sawdust-free, will create a stir in the streets of Athens. There's a hot time in the old town of Dnipropetrovsk tonight. And it is reasonable to assume the same goes for 1,000 other cities, including some Scandinavians. It can at last be said without jinxing the campaign. Somehow, the decadent democracies, the bungling Bolsheviks, the saps and softies, were tougher in the end than the brown shirt bully boys. And smarter, too. For without whipping a priest, burning a book or slugging a Jew, without corralling a girl in a brothel or bleeding a child for plasma, far-flung ordinary men, unspectacular but free, rousing out of their habits in their homes, got up early one morning, flexed their muscles, learned as amateurs the manual of arms, and set out across perilous plains and oceans to whop the bejeepers out of the professionals. This they did.
The CBS Mercury Theater, which was directed by Orson Welles, is perhaps remembered by more people than any other radio drama series. Welles' 1938 production of The War of the Worlds was so realistic it had national repercussions. The story opens with a supposed news flash, interrupting a program in progress to tell listeners that Martians have landed in New Jersey and are spreading death and destruction in their wake. CBS put the script through 38 changes before broadcast in order to stress that it was only a story, fiction. Even so, many listeners were fooled and believed Martians had invaded our planet. Here's part of the dramatic conclusion of War of the Worlds.
This is the end now. Smoke comes out, black smoke drifting over the city. People in the streets see it now. They're running toward the East River, thousands of them, dropping in like rats. Now the smoke's spreading faster. It's reached Times Square. People are trying to run away from it, but it's no use. They're falling like flies. Now the smoke's crossing 6th Avenue. 5th Avenue. 100 yards away. It's 50 feet.
Two X two L calling CQ. 2X2L calling CQ, New York. Is there anyone on the air? Is there anyone on the air? Is there anyone?
This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen. Out of character, to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be. The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo. Starting now, we couldn't soap all your windows and steal all your garden gates by tomorrow night, so we did the next best thing. We annihilated the world before your very ears and utterly destroyed CBS. You will be relieved, I hope, to learn that we didn't mean it and that both institutions are still open for business. So goodbye, everybody, and remember, please, for the next day or so, the terrible lesson you learned tonight. That grinning, glowing, globular invader of your living room is an inhabitant of the pumpkin patch, and if your doorbell rings and nobody's there, that was no Martian. It's Halloween.
This is the Columbia Broadcasting System. Drama on CBS Radio. It prospered for many years, and then at the end of the 1950s, withered and virtually disappeared.
A decade and a half later, with a new generation of listeners, the CBS Radio Mystery Theater, a one-hour drama each night of the week, was born and is heard today. A look at CBS News in the past 25 years when our anniversary broadcast continues.
You are listening to CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound, a three-hour CBS News anniversary broadcast. And now, Bill Schallert for General Electric.
It's been said that the reason we should study history is to be certain we don't repeat the mistakes of others. But another good reason for us to look back into the past is to see how far we've come. This gives us a measurement of progress, something General Electric has been interested in for years. An important example of progress occurred recently in Milwaukee, where GE designs and builds medical equipment. It was there that GE unveiled a new X-ray machine, a computerized tomographic machine designed to scan the total body. In less than 5 seconds, this machine takes tens of thousands of X-ray readings on any part of the body. Then a computer assembles them into pictures that provide much more detail than ordinary X-rays. It helps doctors locate tumors, identify cancers, and analyze problems of many vital organs. It lets doctors see things they could never see before, without surgery. Now that's a pretty good measure of progress when you consider the first X-ray was discovered in 1895. And here's something you probably don't know. The first X-ray operation in America was performed by a New York doctor using an X-ray machine built by Thomas Edison, one of GE's founders. By the turn of the century, there were many X-ray machines being made. All of them, including Edison's, were highly unreliable. It took a young man by the name of Dr. William Coolidge to change that. In 1913, Coolidge was working at the General Electric Research Lab in Schenectady. He developed what was called the hot cathode tube. That tube became the basis for all modern X-ray. No matter how advanced an X-ray machine is today, it still depends on the progress made by Dr. Coolidge. Progress for People, from General Electric.
CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound. Here again is CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite to continue with the third and final hour of our special broadcast commemorating the golden anniversary of the CBS Radio Network.
News was never absent from CBS Radio. In recent years, it has become the heart of the network's schedule. Hourly newscasts around the clock pioneered on CBS Radio. Six of the 7 a.m. radio stations owned by CBS inaugurated and prospered with all news formats in the decade of the late 1960s and early 70s. In an earlier segment of this special broadcast, we listened to the development of broadcast news in the early years. And now we'll look back at CBS News over its second quarter century, from 1952 until 1977. CBS News emerged from World War II as a tested, maturing organization. In those days during the war, radio proved a vital link between the people at home and developments abroad. In the process of meeting that challenge, CBS News became a professional, worldwide news organization, developing guideposts, precedents, policies, and standards as they were needed along the way. Trying to review all the news events that occurred in the last 25 years is, of course, an impossible task. So we thought we would confine ourselves to some of the people and events which most influenced our lives, changed our thinking, renewed our faith, shaped our future, and not so incidentally, also shaped the development of how news is broadcast. The biggest stories radio news covered were the various sorts of wars that involved our country. The Cold War, as President Dwight D. Eisenhower defined it for the nation.
The world is in a ideological struggle, and we're on one side, and the Iron Curtain countries are on the other. This struggle we now are in, we call the Cold War. We are engaged in a war of great ideologies. This is not just a casual argument between slightly differing philosophies, This is light against dark. Freedom against slavery. It is godliness against atheism. That's where we're standing today. That is the struggle.
That ideological struggle went from cold to hot in a very short time. In 1950, we sent troops to Korea as the spearhead of a United Nations force confronting an assault by communist North Korea and backed by the Red Chinese. During the Eisenhower administration, an armistice was finally signed in the summer of 1953, and many thought U.S. military involvement abroad would end. Instead, it spread throughout Southeast Asia and elsewhere. It was gradual at first. In 1957, the United States gave limited money and materiel to the French in Vietnam, who were fighting local communists. U.S. involvement there, on an increasing scale, did not end for almost 20 years. President Eisenhower explained why, in those early years, Indochina, as was called then, was so important to the national interest.
If Indochina goes, several things happen right away. The Krop Peninsula, the last little bit of tin hanging on down there, would be scarcely defensible. The tin and the tungsten that we so greatly value from that area would cease coming. But all India would be outflanked. Somewhere along the line, this must be blocked. Must be blocked now. And that's what the French are doing. So when the United States votes $400 million to help that war, we're not voting for a giveaway program. We're voting for the cheapest way that we can prevent the occurrence of something that would be of the most terrible significance to the United States of America. Our security, our power and ability to get certain things we need from the riches of the Indonesian territory and from Southeast Asia.
Over the years, the deeper the involvement, the more money it cost. In 1965, U.S. troops and materiel were sent to Vietnam in large numbers for the first time, the outgrowth of a still controversial naval engagement involving U.S. ships in the Gulf of Tonkin. At home, Vietnam increasingly thereafter became an issue that divided the country, not fully resolved even by the day in 1975 when U.S. troops finally pulled out and left that devastated peninsula to the communist forces of South Vietnam, the Viet Cong, and to the Vietnamese of the North. Here is CBS News correspondent Bruce Dunning describing the scene at the huge U.S. base at Da Nang as one of the last evacuation planes tried to fly out that day in 1975, and terrified South Vietnamese soldiers and civilians surged onto the airfield trying to force their way aboard the plane.
We're trying to get them on as quickly as we can. They're holding onto the air stair. There's a sea of humanity jamming on. Impossible to stop the crowd. People are falling off the air stairs. We've got about a half dozen people on the plane. Another dozen are there running along, grabbing at the air stair. Our plane is surrounded here. I don't know how the hell we're going to get out. But we're loading the people on as fast as we can. Women and children are obviously being left behind. All around the plane there are people with children, women, standing around. But it's the men who don't have any who are getting on fastest. They're the ones that are jamming up the stairs. We've gotten on about three or four children and a couple of women, and that's all. They've torn apart the railing. The plane is rolling. People are still trying to crawl up these stairs. They're falling off on the runway behind. We're leaving behind a stream of people. The plane is picking up speed, heavily overloaded. The tail is sinking badly. We're trying to get everybody up front. They're taking off on the most rough runway takeoffs I've ever had, but this World Airways crew has done a fantastic job. The men on board are cheering. But it's hardly a case of cheering, I should think. These men have left behind hundreds of thousands of women and children who should have gotten on. We only got on about two or three women and maybe a half dozen kids. We're up in the air. We are out over tonight. We seem to have everybody on. This was the most terrifying experience I've ever had in Vietnam.
Radio news at CBS over the last quarter century has been concerned with the domestic front as well as with foreign coverage. The wars the nation fought overseas left their scars at home, which were to manifest themselves as the 1960s unfolded. The decade started off shaped by the ideals of Camelot,
but the ideas needed implementation that not everyone was willing to undertake. Increasingly, news coverage documented that the poor and minorities were not treated equally in this country, in education, public accommodations, in voting rights. Martin Luther King, a black minister from Atlanta, emerged as one of the spokesmen for the black cause, and at a Washington rally in 1963 gave a speech, carried on CBS radio, that seemed to exemplify all the resentments and hopes.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yes. This will be the day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, 'tis of thee." Yes. Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. So let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi. From every mountainside. Let freedom ring when we happen. When we allow freedom ring. When we let it ring from every village and every hamlet. From every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
In the years before Martin Luther King's stirring speech, the process of trying to integrate schools and universities in the South had caused violent opposition and confrontations, like the first one at Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957. President Eisenhower.
Under the leadership of demagogic extremists, disorderly mobs have deliberately prevented the carrying out of proper orders from a federal court. I have today issued an executive order directing the use of troops under federal authority to aid in the execution of federal law at Little Rock, Arkansas. This became necessary when my proclamation of yesterday was not observed, and the obstruction of justice still continues.
And Governor Orville Faubus of Arkansas replies,
1,200 troops of the 101st Airborne Division were flown into the Jacksonville Air Base by air transport from Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Immediately thereafter, these troops occupied in force the grounds of Central High School. We are now an occupied territory. The tragedy of the whole situation is that the imported judge, by exercising a little patience and understanding, or by the taking of testimony to gain the facts, could have averted the whole development. The federal government has made a grave and grievous error in the federalizing of the Guard and the use of federal troops. The troops are even inside the school building, accompanying the Negro students from class to class. School attendance at Bayonet Point is not compatible with the American way of life.
And finally, after the confrontations and the marches and the sit-ins, it took the death of a president to expedite the passage of three civil rights bills of 1964, 65, and 66, which guaranteed voting rights and open housing, a culmination of a protracted story covered extensively on CBS radio. President Lyndon Johnson spoke to the nation.
All I have, I would have given gladly
not to be standing here today. An assassin's bullet has thrust upon me the awesome burden of the presidency. No memorial oration or eulogy could more eloquently honor President Kennedy's memory than the earliest possible passage of the Civil Rights Bill for which he fought so long.
But President Johnson was not successful in setting a course the nation would follow in Southeast Asia. All across the country, students were dropping out of school in protest of our policies there. Some went on peace marches or set up communes. Others made bombs that killed and disrupted life around them. Most said they were going to make the world a better place, but there were many in the land who doubted young people's motives. And in the continuing surge and counter-surge of Vietnam protest, a group of students was fired on by the National Guard at Kent State in Ohio in 1970. Four were killed. National Guard General Robert Canterbury.
Many members of the crowd closed in on our troops and assaulted them with rocks. Many guardsmen were hit by rocks about the size of baseballs. At that point, the guardsmen fired many tear gas rounds at the crowd. In fact, fired all tear gas rounds on hand at that time. The order was given to return to the commons, and the troops moved out. A crowd estimated that several hundred closed in and assaulted the guard force again with rocks and pieces of concrete. These guardsmen considered that their lives were in danger, which in fact was the case.
The father of 19-year-old Allison Krauss, one of the victims.
She resented being called a bum because she disagreed with someone else's opinion. She felt that war in Cambodia was wrong. Is this dissent a crime? Is this a reason for killing her? Have we come to such a state in this country that a young girl has to be shot because she disagrees deeply with the actions of her government?
The stories covered by CBS News overlaid each other as the 1960s ended and the 70s began. One of them was the condition of women. The Supreme Court gave limited approval to abortion, and people of both sexes began reevaluating themselves and their roles. As CBS News correspondent Dan Rather reported in a CBS radio special about women in 1973. Clearly, the American woman is beginning to avail herself of the new options opening up for her, options she never dared consider before. The sheer number of women moving out on their own is so great, and the directions in which they are moving so varied, that behavioral conformity is about as obsolete as Detroit's year-end models. Of course, what must be borne in mind is that it's not simply the men who have all the readjusting to do. The American woman is having difficulties not only because some are carrying out their own experiments with independence and have male backlash to deal with, but because a great mass of American women are largely content. For while liberation has been tagged a woman's movement, the more appropriate term in the end may conceivably become a people's movement. Men and women looking at each other with new awareness. CBS News correspondents and reporters covered the continuing story of politics and presidents. In 16 years, we elected four presidents to the Oval Office. Two gained it unelected. One was assassinated. CBS Radio on that unforgettable day, November 22nd, 1963.
Motorcade, something has happened here. We understand there has been a shooting. The presidential car coming up now. We know it's the presidential car. You see Mrs. Kennedy's pink suit. There's a Secret Service man, spread eagle, over the top of the car. We understand Governor and Mrs. Connolly are in the car with President and Mrs. Kennedy. We can't see who has been hit, if anybody has been hit, but apparently something is wrong here. Something is terribly wrong.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States is dead. John F. Kennedy has died of the wounds received in assassination in Dallas.
CBS News correspondent Alan Jackson. After that, there was a rash of similar killings. Malcolm X in 1965 and then 1968, a year of unremitting major news stories. Martin Luther King is shot. CBS Radio at the moment of crisis.
I was in room 309. Dr. King was in room 306, less than 60 feet away. As soon as I turned on the television set, he came on the screen, speaking to the audience he had addressed the night before. He was saying very powerfully that he was ready to die.
Difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now. Because I've been to the mountaintop. And I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live.
When the program ended, I reached over to turn the set down. That was when I heard the shot ring out, and I rushed out on the balcony. I saw Dr. King lying about 40 feet away. Ralph Abernathy was there, and so was Andy Young. Police poured down the street, running with rifles. The scene was confused and frantic. An ambulance arrived, but there wasn't much anyone could do. I knew they had killed him. It was hard to believe, after all the threats and close calls, that it had finally happened here, at a motel in Memphis, Tennessee.
That same year, Robert Kennedy, the dead president's brother, decided to run for president. The incumbent president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, decided not to.
I have concluded that I should not permit the presidency to become involved in the partisan divisions that are developing in this political year. Accordingly, I shall not see, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
A surprise to almost everyone but the president himself. And then it was June. Robert Kennedy won the California primary, an evening that began for Kennedy in triumph and ended in yet more bloodshed.
My thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there.
Senator Kennedy has been shot. Is that possible? Is that possible? It could. Is it possible, ladies and gentlemen? It is possible. He has. Not only Senator Kennedy. Oh, my God. Senator Kennedy has been shot. Possibly shot in the head. He still has the gun. The gun is pointed at me right at this moment. I hope they can get the gun out of his hand. Be very careful. Get the gun.
Take a hold of his thumb and break it if you have to. Get his thumb.
All right.
Everybody, please.
That's it, Raper. Get it. Hold him. We don't want another Oswald.
My brother need not be idealized or enlarged in death beyond what he was in life. To be remembered simply as a good and decent man who saw wrong and tried to right it, saw suffering and tried to heal it, saw war and tried to stop it. Those of us who loved him and who take him to his rest today pray that what he was to us, what he wished for others, will someday come to pass for all the world. As he said many times in many parts of this nation, to those he touched and who sought to touch him, some men see things as they are and say, why? I dream things that never were and say, why not?
Richard Nixon won a first term as president and then another, and in 1974 resigned from office, his career shattered by the Watergate scandal. For the next 2 years, President Nixon's chosen successor, Gerald Ford, tried to keep the nation on an even keel. And in 1976, Jimmy Carter, driving for the presidency, pledged in his campaign to lead the nation to a new beginning.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. I regret deeply any injuries that may have been done in the course of the events that led to this decision. To those who have stood with me during these past difficult months, I will be eternally grateful for your support. And to those who have not felt able to give me your support, let me say, I leave with no bitterness.
My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over.
It's now time for healing. We want to have faith again. We want to be proud again. We just want the truth again. It's time for the people to run the government and not the other way around.
Watergate was the worst scandal involving the head of government since the Teapot Dome of the 1920s, and perhaps the worst in all our history. The Senate Watergate Committee hearings were carried in their entirety, more than 119 hours on CBS radio. Former White House counsel John Dean was a key witness.
As the president discussed the present status of the situation, I told him that all I'd been able to do was to contain the case and assist in keeping it out of the White House. I also told him that there was a long way to go before this matter would end, and that I certainly could make no assurances that the day would not come when this matter would not start to unravel. I began by telling the president that there was a cancer growing on the presidency, and if the cancer was not removed, the president himself would be killed by it. I also told him that it was important that this cancer be removed immediately because it was growing more deadly every day.
But the nation heard about its triumphs as well as its tragedies on CBS radio. The first man on the moon, astronaut Neil Armstrong, July 20th, 1969.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue.
I'm at the foot of the ladder. The lamb footbeds are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches, although the surface appears to be very, very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder down there. It's very fine. I'm going to step off the limb now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
And the United States celebrated its 200th birthday, a vast and unprecedented challenge to CBS News radio coverage.
We lost the American colonies because we lacked that statesmanship to know the right time and the manner of yielding what is impossible to keep.
They came here in the snows of winter over a trail marked with the blood of their rag-bound feet. Americans will remember the name of Valley Forge as long as the spirit of sacrifice lives within their hearts.
Many challenges remain subjects of extensive CBS News coverage on radio as our decade winds down. The economy, energy, and natural resources, our environment, the condition of the cities, and other overriding news stories, known and unknown. CBS News correspondent Eric Severide's career in news has spanned this era in which CBS News has moved toward maturity. Severide reached retirement age in 1977, but recently in a CBS News radio special dealing with American wisdom, he commented on what our past has taught us and our ability to meet the challenges that lie ahead.
There remains in the American spirit an implicit belief that problems can be solved. Maybe there is an innocence about this country's approach to life. And this innocence gets us into a lot of trouble. Yet this instinct amounts to a kind of wisdom, for it bears on the preservation of the species. It makes creativity possible. It says yes to life and no to cynicism, which is death for the spirit. Man may be trapped between earth and a glimpse of heaven, but no people fasten on the glimpse so steadily. With all our innocent and damaging mistakes, the world is fortunate in the end that one great nation at least believes in a better and better life. Perhaps that is why millions of people in other lands still want to come here. America is not what's wrong with the world. For ordinary people, it is the best thing that ever happened to the world. And this knowledge, this wisdom, is a calm eye at the center of the hurricane of our self-criticism, our periodic self-doubt.
The development of broadcast news, a 50-year experiment on CBS radio, that continues. Tomorrow will teach us something else.
And now Bill Schellert with a closing word from General Electric.
Next year, the General Electric Company will be 100 years old. And tonight, you've heard about some of the progress that General Electric research has made possible in those 100 years. If the past is any guide to the future, they'll keep right on making it. Energy, transportation, the environment, those are just some of the fields where GE is working right now. And as you might expect, they're making progress. Progress for People from General Electric.
Now, with a closing report, CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite.
Radio has changed as America's listening habits have changed. During the 3 hours of this CBS Radio's 50th anniversary special, we've been hearing how it used to be. Today, radio at CBS sounds like this.
First Line Report.
I'm Bob Schieffer, CBS.
This is Dallas Townsend with the CBS World News Roundup.
Newsbreak. Charles Osgood on the
CBS. Newsbreak PM. This is Reed Collins.
What's happening? I'm Stephanie Shelton reporting
on
the
World of Religion.
I'm Douglas Edwards, CBS.
And the Spotlight. This is Lee Jordan.
The Law and You. I'm Fred Graham.
CBS. It's your Earth. I'm Nelson Benton.
The CBS Radio Mystery Theater.
Welcome. I'm E.G. Marshall.
Good morning. Jim Kelly with the Sports World Roundup on the
Pat Summerall on the CBS Radio Network with predictions.
Win Elliott, Sports Center at USA for the...
I'm Ron Weber with Sports Time.
I'm Brent Musburger with Sports Time.
Time now to meet the cook. Ralph Story here.
This Line America. I'm Charles Carroll.
Washington Watch. I'm Bruce Morton. CBS.
This is Charles Collingwood reporting.
Face the Nation. A spontaneous...
Morley Safer's Journal commentary.
Might tell us at large.
This is Lawrence Johnson on the CBS Radio Network with What's New and Learning.
Reporter at Large. I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Phyllis Schlafly for Spectrum.
This is The World Tonight. Good evening. I'm Douglas Edwards.
This is Walter Cronkite reporting.
Today in Business. I'm Ray Brady reporting.
Mormon Tabernacle Choir from Temple Square in Salt Lake City.
William S. Paley, who was there when it all began, remains firmly committed to radio as a central method of modern communication.
Radio is a very important medium. I don't think most people realize the importance of it. From the standpoint of national security, it's absolutely essential. It's the only medium that can reach all the people at a moment's notice, no matter what calamity might befall the country. So it's a necessary medium. And at the same time, of course, it takes care of people who either don't like television or who are too busy to be sitting in front of a television set, who want to walk around and be entertained or informed. It's becoming more and more of an information medium. Oh, it's really divided almost in two. Either stations that put a great accent on music, practically nothing else, with just a few minutes of news every once in a while, and stations that put a great accent on information and discussion. And we chose the latter course. It's a more expensive way of going about it, but it does provide a very important service. And I think it's a product that is indestructible from the standpoint of the kind of demand that there will always be for it. I pride myself in the quality of our news organization. It's certainly by far the best of any organization in broadcasting, and I think it compares favorably with any organization, even in the print media. And therefore, we're better equipped to do an all-news station operation than almost any other network or any other organization.
William Paley. For the last 3 hours, we've been sharing with you a look back at CBS Radio's first 50 years. Undoubtedly, there were voices and sounds you expected to hear and did not. We hope that those you did hear, you enjoyed. They may have carried you back, and perhaps in the larger picture, informed you. I'm Walter Cronkite, CBS News.
You have been listening to a special 3-hour CBS Radio anniversary broadcast. CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound, sponsored by General Electric. This broadcast was written and produced by Joan Martin Burke with Maurice Lee Robinson. Technical supervision, Mortimer Goldberg. Assistant to the producers, Martin Werber. Research, Catherine Sulks. Executive producer, Dick Reeves. The entire production was supervised by Emerson Stone. Bob Height speaking. This is the CBS Radio Network.